Good morning. We're going to start by conceding that the House has failed the green test. Senator Bach and Senator Juan in particular, I am wearing dark green. It's very dark, and I have green earrings on. But look at the Senate conference. And look at the House conference. You failed the test.
Madam Chair, I do have green slacks on.
Green slacks. I don't know. Is that green? What do you think, Senator Bach?
Only if you're colorblind.
Do I have to stand to prove it?
No, Senator Bach, and look at Mr. Manson. You did well. But, you know, I'm really worried about our most fashionable conferee of all, who also failed the test, Representative Dietrich. Oh, my goodness. What's happened to the House?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Bach.
Representative Dietrich, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you.
We missed you yesterday.
Yesterday?
Good answer. Last night. She didn't have to be here.
Our sixth conferee showed up.
That was about 1 a.m, that's right.
Madam Chair, maybe you should tell the people that left what happened at 1 a.m.
Well, at 1 a.m, Senate Majority Leader and the Speaker of the House came down. And the House Majority Leader visited with the remaining conferees. Get a lot done? Till 1:20?
I think when you asked the question if they came to deliver a target, I think they thought you were being silly because they didn't, I don't remember that they even answered.
I don't think they answered. And I think Senator Marty asked him some questions and they didn't answer those either. And they just left.
Scared enough.
Senator Bach, though, look at House Research back here. Look how green they are. They're getting it.
Green. Wow, they're green.
We're going to work on the Senate a little bit. Some of the DFL staff, we're going to work on. Everyone's going to be listening to Senator Mao really clearly later today. Orange kind of threw us for a curve, though, some of us who got it. We all thought, where would we get orange?
By request. But consensus overruled, Madam Chair.
So, Senator Skoy, do you have a really nice orange shirt?
I do.
You do?
I do.
Well, we might all have to find an orange highlighter as Representative Simpson's wearing his green highlighter and Senator Marty. Maybe we'll all wear orange highlighters so we can see that shirt. Maybe that's what we should do.
Madam Chair?
Got to be on the side.
Representative Simpson.
I think at one point next week we should all wear red because I can see where this is going.
Oh.
I think we might as well just do a red day.
Senator Bach? When in the House Tax Committee, when we were talking about, you know, some really good House ideas, Representative Simpson would pull out his red pen and start writing so I could get his signal. You think about that. He was a conduit for the governor.
Very subtle.
Yeah. Do you have anyone doing that in the Senate? Anybody with a red pen? Even people focused?
Senator Sanjo sat next to me with his red.
Oh, same thing. Well, seriously, Senator and everyone, we actually have something we can really do here today, and that is that Ms. Zoff and Mr. Michael have, I think it was the first day, we asked them to go through the four technical or department articles and give us their recommendations, and they've got some stuff for us, and I think we can actually try to take a shot at working through some things. So if whoever would like to start, I think members should all
have to. Were you implying the day that I had the gavel, we did nothing?
We've done a lot. As you know, Mr. Manson's told us how much we've done.
Check. I thought we got a lot done last night, that last half hour. Learned about sand greens.
Yeah. Learned a little bit about each other. Who likes to play golf? That's all important.
So who would like to begin? We're ready when you are. Should all have this one page.
All right, Madam Chair, I think it'll work best to just work off the side by side. And you want to start on page 78. And this is a product the staff got together and essentially went through the department articles that had been incorporated into the two bills and made some recommendations as to things that we suspect there'd be no concern about adopting at this point. Starting with the income and franchise tax article, it starts at the beginning of page 78. As you see from the side-by-side, the vast majority of the sections are identical, either in both bills' department income and franchise tax article, or in some instances the House had pulled some of these sections out and incorporated them into their policy articles. But we would recommend that you adopt those, essentially adopt the Senate article, which contains all of the department's proposals, and that would bring in those corresponding sections from the House without the substantive changes that were recommended. In addition to that, there are a couple of sections in the House policy articles that could be adopted with respect to just some technical changes and clarifying changes. The first is House Article 4, Section 5, which is the AMT income definition, and we'd recommend that you just incorporate the provisions that correct a cross-reference, not the more substantive provision dealing with royalties. House Article 5, Section 4, includes a clarifying phrase that was recommended by the department to provide that these subtractions would each begin with "to the extent included in federal taxable income."
Senator Bach, I was just noticing Ms. Zoff has green pens. I guess she's even qualified. She's got two of them there. Wow. Well, Senator Bach, what do you think about all that?
I'm glad, Madam Chair.
The income and franchise tax article. Does anyone have questions on any of these items? I think they all seem pretty straightforward. There are not, Senator Bach, the House will move the first bullet there to adopt the Senate article. Any questions? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Nay. Is adopted. And the next one, Senator Bach and conferees, to add House Article 4, Section 5, just to clarify again now, this is only the cross-reference, but we're not going to touch the royalty provision because we have different positions on that. Is that right, Ms. Zoff?
Yes.
And the House will move adoption of the next bullet, adding House Article 4, Section 5, correction of cross-reference only, not royalty provision. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. And last, everyone understands this one as well. I guess one question on this. The not out-of-state military service or national service education award, yes, I wasn't clear, Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, those are the substantive provisions. Essentially, all we're recommending here is you adopt this. Adding the phrases to several of these subtractions that say "to the extent of federal taxable income."
Okay. Is there a discussion of that? Concerns? Anyone? If not, the House moves to add House Article 5, Section 4, as listed here in the third bullet point. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? That is adopted.
Madam Chair?
Senator Bach.
Parliamentary question. When I first came here, and Representative Carlson will probably remember this, and I sat on the environment, one of the committees I sat on was environment policy. And I always remember Representative Munger, who was a real stickler on proper protocol, handed out a card to all of his new committee members, and I remember it said, "Motions pass. Amendments are adopted." What's the third one?
Something's prevail. Prevail.
Motions prevail. Amendments are adopted and bills are passed. Representative Carlson, does that sound right?
Sounds right. I wasn't listening carefully enough to what we just did.
And Senator Bach?
I think we were adopting motions. I think Representative Munger, who's, I think, Minnesota's longest-serving legislator, would have said, the motions prevailed. So you know how the Senate is kind of stickler about rules.
Mayor Bach, that begs the question, what we're moving them.
Well, you made a motion, and I think we decided motions prevail. Yes. I think the motion would prevail and the amendment is adopted.
Well, Senator Bach, I've heard it every which way from all kinds of chairs.
And we can check with counsel.
As long as the tape has the gist of what just happened, I think we're good.
Why don't I check?
We'll let you be a stickler.
Why don't we check? Well, I'll check with Peter Watson here, our fine Senate counsel, and see what, so that we get this right. Because with a little luck at all, we might be doing this again next year. And we should find out what the proper verbiage is. Because I'm not even sure. Also, what do you think? Motions prevail.
Mm-hmm.
Amendments are adopted. Mm-hmm. Bills pass.
We really are a stickler, Senator Bach. We're just so much.
To.
That's right.
I agree.
House, we're just much more relaxed.
Representative Dietrich, what do you think?
I do, Madam Chair.
Dietrich, yes.
I do remember it is amendment is adopted. So that's all I can work from. But and bills passed, I think. Yeah, I think you're right.
Motion prevails or does not prevail.
Depends on if it prevails.
Representative Dabney. This is neither a bill or an amendment.
If I make a motion to adopt an amendment, then wouldn't and the votes are on my side, then my motion prevails. And the amendment is adopted. So it's not that the straight to the amendment is adopted, because you'd have to acknowledge the motion first.
I think you would move the plural. You would move adoption of the amendment, and then if the motion prevails, the amendment is adopted.
Senator Bach, I want to ask your Senate conferees, does he do this in the Senate Tax Committee a lot, too?
Madam Chair, I move Senator we Bach. Move on.
Senator Marty is right. That's what we should do. And you know, though, Senator Bach, I don't know that we're moving what we're moving. So we're working off a House file. And are these amendments? I don't know. I think they were moving House positions and Senate positions, so I don't know what qualifies
we're
in that case.
Moving motions.
Ms. Soft.
Madam Chair, the next article is the Department Sales and Use Tax article. That begins on page 80 of the side-by-side. And both the House and the Senate article have... They're identical throughout except for one provision, and that is with respect to the taxation of the delivery charges for aggregate materials. You'll see that on page 81. It's section 5 on the House side, and it is the second to the last paragraph there. The Senate had removed that provision.
Senator Scoy?
Well, Madam Chair, I remember this. I'm trying to recollect the rationale for that, but I think that might...
You want Representative Simpson?
Just a question, Madam Chair. Are independent haulers paying a tax now? Is that what we're trying to get at?
Sorry, I apologize. Yes.
Are independent haulers paying a tax now? Is that what we're trying to get at here? So it would be equal?
Mr. Michael, you want to bring us all back to this bill, maybe, or Ms. Off? I don't know. I mean, I sense that we're not ready to adopt this provision, but Mr. Michael... Do you want to move off?
I think,
please.
Madam Chair, the reason why this was removed in the committee and the Senate is that essentially the department made their case that they were trying to accomplish a similar treatment regardless of who was delivering the aggregate so that it would apply to those who were delivering it for themselves. And I think a statement had been made in the presentation that everyone had gotten together and everyone agreed on it, and then one individual stepped up and said, no, not everyone agrees, and we didn't have, you know, I think it was just set aside at that point to find out if there was some conflict there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bach.
Mr. Manson, what's the dispute?
And Mr. Manson, before
Madam
you
Chair.
Answer, is this, just to help House conferees as well, the same kind of question, is this the deal where people were moving where they're unloading the stuff to avoid the tax?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Bach, this is a very difficult situation, both from our standpoint and the taxpayer standpoint. And generally, if you deliver, if you're the seller and you deliver the goods, both of those are taxable. The delivery service and the taxable and the good is taxable. This is the only instance where third-party deliveries are taxable. And what's happening is, what we're saying is, if it's actually spread where it's going to be placed, then it's an improvement to realty and it's not a taxable event. But if it's just dumped, then it's delivery of a taxable item and that's taxable. So it's hard for us and it's hard for the taxpayers to determine, you know, how it's going to be delivered on the site. And so it's something we worked with we're going to come out with a revenue notice, which is what is in the bill. This would be our current position is in the bill, and we're going to come out with a revenue notice. And the industry's objected to that approach, and we worked with them, and they met on their own and really couldn't come to an agreement or conclusion on how to approach us. So we put it in our bill to kind of just, we need to resolve this issue somehow, and so that's why it's in the bill. We pulled it from the Senate bill because at that point we weren't kind of entertaining controversial items. And this was still up in the air. So there's really no resolve to this. The only other option that would take care of the majority of the problem would be to exempt these deliveries by third parties. And that would take care of some of them, and there's a cost to that. So this is kind of the current department position, and we've dealt with this a long time, too. We think this is our best approach without some other kind of law change. And so that's kind of where it's at.
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Manson, isn't the issue that on some of these building sites, sometimes there's a timing issue where they bring the gravel in and put it in a pile and then spread it out on the road later, and then they would have to pay tax, and if they didn't have a weather issue and they brought it in and spread it out, then they wouldn't pay tax, and isn't that the heart of that issue?
Mr. Manson.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, yeah, that is some of the issues we did here. And our position is if it's put in a pile, then it's a taxable delivery.
Yeah.
But if it's spread in place, then it's not. And that was some of the concerns they had, was because of the time of when they could actually spread it, or if they'd bid a contract and then not knowing whether, and then it comes back and we said it was taxable. And it's not a very easy issue, and it's just, you know, more complexing, and because of the third-party deliveries as well. And like I said, this is the only third-party delivery that is taxable, and that was something that the legislature did right after we came out with taxing delivery charges. So.
Cool. Mr. Manson, I had two different road projects, same contractor. I have two jobs, and I use my trucks to move material from one site to the other. That's not taxable. But if I hire some independent person to move the gravel from one site to the other, same function, but then it would be taxable?
Maybe.
Madam Chair and Senator Bach, I think, maybe Pat Dalton, but I think you have to be the seller of the goods and delivering it at the same time. I don't think if you're not the seller of the aggregate or whatever, and you just move from one place to the other, then those delivery charges are not taxed, I believe, or moving charges or whatever.
What if
spreading.
I hire a third party?
That's when it's taxable. That's when
move
it comes
it.
Taxable.
If the goods have already been paid for, and then you come in later and then move it, that's not a taxable event. It has to be that you're delivering the goods that you're just purchasing at that time. That's when the delivery charges are taxable. But Ms. Dalton probably has a better response than that.
Ms. Dalton will add to this. But, you know, I think part of the issue here is, I think this is coming back to me now. And I think we've got a disparate situation on who's being taxed. And one way to do it would be just exempt everybody. That's money on the spreadsheet. And I think the way the House has it actually levels the playing field by having them all be taxed. It doesn't cost money on the spreadsheet. So I think that's kind of the crux of the issue. Ms. Dalton?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, a couple of years ago, as part of streamlined sales tax, we went to taxing delivery, including delivery charges, in the taxable sale price. And the industry came to the legislature and said, we have a lot of third-party haulers. So this disadvantages aggregate dealers who sell and deliver themselves, because they would have to include the delivery charge in their taxable sales price. But if there's an aggregate dealer who used a third-party hauler to move the aggregate to the site, they would not be charged. The delivery charge would not be subject to the sales tax. That's why the law was changed to basically say, if it is a taxable transaction going on, the delivery charge is taxable regardless of who is making a delivery. The law, as it, you know, deals with what is a improvement to real property, then gets involved in this. An improvement to real property, when they essentially spread it in place as an improvement to real property and it's not a retail sale, and then it's not subject to sales tax. So right now, the third-party haulers are the ones who are at a slight disadvantage, because right now it says if it's a taxable transaction, they have to charge sales tax regardless of whether it is dumped substantially in place or whether it is not. Now, in the instance that Senator Bach was talking about, if you already have the aggregate and you're moving it from one site to another, there's no taxable transaction going on. And so whether you use your own truck or whether you hire a third-party hauler would not invoke a sales tax, because there is no taxable transaction occurring. This only deals with third-party deliverers when there is a taxable transaction occurring.
Senator Bach, I think we should lay this temporarily over and move on, because appear to be ready to have a motion.
I think the contractors who have an issue with this are probably on their way into the Capitol. Maybe we could get from them.
We can come back to it.
What their concern was.
Okay. Good. It's off.
Madam Chair, the next article, there were two additional House provisions that were essentially related to positions that were taken by the Department of Revenue that had not been included in the original draft and are not in the Senate of the department bill and are not in the Senate policy articles. The first is House Article 6, Section 5, and that provides an exemption for the sale of kidney dialysis equipment, and this is an issue of conformity with the streamlined sales tax agreement. And there are other streamlined sales tax provisions in the department article, so it seemed consistent to pull this in.
Discussion? Senator Bach is...
Senator Marty's provision, I think.
Yeah. Senator Marty moves to adopt that we add House Article 6, Section 5. Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? What would you like me to say, Senator Bach? The motion prevails. Thank you.
I'm not sure, Madam Chair, but I think we'll have Senate counsel come in and...
Sounds good.
I'm a little older and grayer than you, so I'll probably be gone from here before you, but you might be here long enough to hand out little cards like Representative Munger did to the new people get off on the right foot.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Munger, I have to be particularly careful because I reside in his office. Where any of the environmentalists come in, and I'm thinking that maybe he's
there
watching.
Yes.
That was a very nice corner office.
It was.
Still is?
Still is.
Senator Bakken, it's perfectly clean. Sam Carlson has one of the cleanest cleanest offices in the Minnesota House.
No.
Very organized.
I think he can look out the window and watch the Senate at work, too.
Ms. Ott.
Corner office of the devil.
Madam Chair, the final provision is the addition of House Article 6, Section 7, just summarized on page 43 of the side-by-side. And this was proposed. House staff had drafted this provision in response to a proposed Department of Revenue policy dealing with the exemption of fuels used in agricultural production. There was a feeling that possibly what the department was proposing needed to be stated explicitly in the law. So Article 6, Section 7 is intended to accomplish that. And because it's in response to a department position, it seemed consistent to pull it into this article.
Discussion on this one. Mr. Manson?
Madam Chair, this was one of those, came a result of those meetings we had with industry on many of farm issues. And we did issue a revenue notice that is in line with the proposal in the bill. So I think both the department and the industry think it'd be good to have it in the statute. And it is our current position based on a revenue notice.
Discussion? None? Representative Simpson, you're in support of this, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, Representative Simpson moves to add House Article 6, Section 7. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Let's move the Senate article.
I'm not following. Mr. Michael, help me out here.
Madam Chair, we essentially the House and the Senate articles are
okay.
Identical except
okay.
except for the aggregate provision, which the Senate removed. So you could adopt the Senate
right.
article then, and if you decide not to hold on the aggregate, we could do that in the general sales tax and
right.
have this closed. And, or if you decide in a half an hour to do it, we can still include
yeah.
it.
No, I think, does everyone think that's okay? I think we should do that then. So I will move the Senate article. Discussion? Not? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Okay. We're getting a lot done now. Okay, Ms. Zoff. Page 88.
Madam Chair, members, yes, this is the property taxes and AIDS articles from the department. And here it's not, we're skipping around a little bit more. We would propose that you would adopt a number of sections, 1 through 22 on the House side, which are the same as Senate sections 2 to 23. And then beginning, and I don't know if you want to take some time to look at these or if you just want to go through them here, since they are the same in this first bullet. Sections beginning on page 91 of the side-by-side, sections 25,
section 24, are we on, page 91?
Madam Chair, yes. Section 24, 25, then skipping ahead to page 92 of the side-by-side. All sections 29 and 30 are the same in both. And then beginning on the bottom of page 92 of the side-by-side, sections 33 through 51 are the same as what is proposed in the Senate bill.
Okay. here.
Yes,
okay.
Then,
I think that's okay.
These are all the same.
Okay.
These are other differences.
So Senator Bach moves the first, everything listed on the first bullet. Is everyone catching that? Adopt House sections and listed Senate sections, which are all the same. Discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails.
And, excuse me, Madam Chair and members, going back to page 91, there's a difference in section 23 of the House bill and section 24 of the Senate bill having to do with Social Security numbers on certificates of real estate value. And the Senate Tax Committee, there had been some feeling that a county auditor would be able to accept a certificate of real estate value without a Social Security number if the deed includes a statement that the spouse whose Social Security number would otherwise be required does not claim any ownership in the property.
Mr. Manson, do people need to have a Social Security number on if the deed includes a statement that the named spouse claims no ownership interest?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that we do prefer the Senate provision, and that we've worked with interested parties, and they're just to ensure that a statement is included for deed purposes. So, Senate provision would be our preference.
Okay. So you prefer the Senate language, Mr. Manson. Do the
I'm
House
sure
conferees have a problem with that? It's, it seems okay. Then Representative Marquardt moves Senate position there to adopt Senate Section 24 on page 91 of the side-by-side. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Say nay. The motion prevails.
Madam Chair, members, the next provision is at the bottom of page 91, section 26 in the House and 27 in the Senate. And the staff would recommend that you would adopt the House provision because the Senate removed some language that had been in the original department proposal, but that I think the department now concurs went too far, so they would prefer the House language as well, that we should leave that language in place.
Did you have a thought, Senator Scoy?
No, I didn't.
Representative Marquardt.
That?
Representative Marquardt moves that we adopt House Section 26, page 91 in the spreadsheet. All discussion?
Oops. Did all you say House or Senate?
What in, the House.
House.
Did I don't know what I said, Senator Scoy, honestly, but I meant the House.
Okay.
Okay, is that okay? Okay, so Representative Marquardt's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion is adopted.
On page 92 of the side-by-side, the next issue would be House Section 27, the first section on the side-by-side. This deals with, this is a more substantive provision. The department's original proposal had authorized the assessor, dealt with the treatment of property that's subject to conservation easements. And the Senate, in its substantive property tax article, modified this provision so that the value of property that is subject to a conservation easement could be adjusted by the assessor and could be either increased or decreased. The current law specifies that the property is entitled to a reduction in value, but this would give the assessor the option to provide an increase, a decrease, or leave it alone.
Senator Bach, Representative Wagenius, I think, would appreciate the House taking the Senate position here. I think Representative Carlson as well has stepped out. But we have had some discussion of this, and I think House members on the whole would appreciate that the Senate has a little better language here. So is there discussion? Then I will move the Senate position to adopt Article 5, Section 18, page 92 of the spreadsheet. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails.
Madam Chair, members, the next provision that is at issue is section 28 on the House, in the House article, and this is a difference in the effective date, and the Senate effective date was for taxes payable in 2007 and thereafter, and that time has passed. So the department proposes the change in the House that's incorporated in the House provision, which would make this effective for notices required in 2008 and later.
Discussion?
So move.
Representative Marquardt moves that House Section 28 on page 92 of the spreadsheet be adopted. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails.
Madam Chair, the next provision at issue is in the middle of that page. It is section 31 in both bills and deals with the requirements for homestead applications. The Senate bill included the original department language, but that struck language that requires the commissioner to prescribe the form and the contents that's used in this process. And I believe the department concurs that that striking went too far and that the House language that leaves in some of that detail as to the development of the forms should be adopted.
Senator Bach, no one? Senator Bach has given me the nod, so Senator Bach moves the House position, section 31, page 92 of the spreadsheet. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. As opposed, say nay. The motion prevails.
And the next provision, there's a difference that can be resolved, is on page 95 of the side-by-side. Section 52 of the House article.
Madam Chair,
perhaps
one question is for Mr. Manson. I guess as we go through on page 93, where we're talking about the fact that county board members and other relatives, for example, cannot decide on assessment values and that type of thing. Is that all part of trying to clean up the assessment practices and all that? Because I know a number of us constantly hear about this situation, about assessors and kind of unfairness. Is this all part of that? And that's, I guess, on the House side, it's section 38 and 39. And is that part of that strategy or
effort? Mr. Manson?
Madam Chair and Representative Marquardt, yes, it is. It's kind of just dealing with kind of a conflict of interest that you're, you know, deciding on your
good
own
thing.
Appeals.
There it is, for that.
Yes.
Madam Chair, on the comparison of House Section 52 and Senate Section 56, which is the repealer section, the Senate had included a provision that had repealed a law that allowed the county treasurer to be involved in, to unilaterally abate property tax penalty amounts. The thinking on the part of the department when they proposed that was that this would eliminate a conflict between two current laws and that no county was making use of the provision that was proposed to be repealed, but they subsequently found that there was a county that was making at least one, maybe more, that were making use of that provision, so they would now propose that we adopt the House provision, which does not repeal that.
Very good. Discussion? Senator Skoy, do you have any concerns about that, or are you okay with that?
I am fine with that, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Skoy moves that we adopt House Section 52 on page 95 of the spreadsheet. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The motion prevails.
Okay. And then the final provision that we would recommend including in this article at this point is toward the bottom of page 96. Section 50 on the Senate side is the same as the provision that's in Article 3, Section 31 of the House bill.
Discussion? Representative Marquardt moves that we adopt the Senate Section 50 on page 96 of the spreadsheet. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. The motion prevails.
And there were, Madam Chair, there were a number of provisions, if you want to just review them, that we did not include in this recommendation because they seemed like they needed to be resolved in a more substantive discussion. They were relating to other issues that are going to be decided. Looking at page 92, section 32 of the House Article 12 deals with, on the Senate side, deals with the requirement that they farm at least 40 acres to be considered actively farming. So we would recommend that you decide that in the context of the property tax article.
Senator Bach? Senator Bach, this piece is, there's an issue for Representative Junkie that we are trying to fix here, and maybe a couple folks could work this out. Maybe Senator Skoyan, Representative Marquardt, or Representative Simpson. Or I think this wouldn't take much, but we need to make sure Representative Junkie's issue is dealt with. And is it a child farming for taking care of his mom's property, but they were non-contiguous? There's a number of things going on there. We all thought it made sense, and we think you would think so.
Madam Chair, I've heard about the issue. I'd just like to learn a little more about it.
Madam Chair, maybe we could appoint a little ag working group to work on some ag issues.
Great idea.
They could meet tomorrow. They'd be fine with me.
While you're golfing.
Appointing Senator Wong?
I would be very good at that, Madam Chair.
Senator Juan, I learned a little something about farming last night at dinner.
Really?
We learned about, were they called square foot gardens?
Square foot gardens.
Square foot gardens. Senator Juan is going to be St. Paul's newest potato farmer after dinner last night.
That's right.
I may be the next potato farmer on Lake Vermilion.
Sounds good.
It's interesting. I told my wife about it. She said, what?
Oh, that's cool.
Do you mound the dirt up like normally up high? I garden too. We actually garden in the suburbs too.
On a pretty expensive
lots of vegetables.
Land.
Lots of vegetables.
It was interesting.
Madam Chair, how is your garden doing?
Well, I normally don't put my vegetables in the ground till at least May 30th because the soil's not warm enough anyhow, so they just sit there. They don't do anything. And the average annual last frost is about May 10th in the Twin Cities. So if you put anything in before that, it's pretty risky. You've got to cover every night. So I'm sure where a number of these folks are, that sounds really early. We warm up a little quicker down here.
Madam Chair, in northeastern Minnesota, it's after the full moon in June.
Big difference, yes. So, Senator Bach, when do you get a tomato? How long does it take to get a tomato where you are?
Depends on how close they're planted to the wall of your garage.
Get the heat reflection. Right. Yeah, no, that's key. The hotter, the better. Makes for a better tomato. Okay, Ms. Zoff.
Then there are a few remaining provisions on page 96 of the side-by-side that were in the Senate bill, but not in the House bill. One is section one that deals with the offset of the wheelage taxes, and that is also addressed in the transportation bill. And then section 32 and 34 and 35, we would recommend that they relate more closely to issues that are going to be dealt with in the property tax, the substantive articles, so we would suggest you defer a decision on those.
Okay. Senator Bach, it seems like those next two we have to wait on. Do you agree?
Agreed.
And I think that first one, if the transportation conferees don't do the wheelage tax, we're going to have to come back and probably repeal that language because it affected levy limits. So, you know, you might have someone here might have a better read on what's going to happen in the Transportation Conference Committee or what's going to pass, but we have to wait on those. So thank you. And we agreed, was Senator Skoy and Representative Marquardt, Representative Simpson, who's ever interested, going to work on that, the issue for Representative Junkie, and figure that out, too?
Maybe Senator Mark or Representative Marquardt, you're going to be a senator someday.
I know. Hate to hear that.
I can tell his hair is falling out, and he'll be ready for his wig in about 3 years. 4 years, maybe.
What do those wigs look like? You have one?
You know what I have.
Yeah, you need to bring that in here. We need a better look. There's a marker.
Well, I think Madam Chair and Senator Bach, if you do that, you have to get that fit, and then you always have it ordered like one or two sizes too small, according to Representative Rukavina. You all have your wigs on a little too tight over here. That's his words.
We're going to get to that later. Maybe not today.
Bet we will.
Yes, we will.
Representative Chesky, maybe I could suggest that Representative Marquardt pick a counterpart on your side and Senator Skoy pick a counterpart on our side that start working on the ag provisions.
I think that's a great idea.
For those of us that don't know anything about ag, other than I know about potato gardening now.
I think that's a good idea.
Senator Maul, I would be happy to do.
Thank you. So that would be great. Okay, Ms. Off, special taxes, page 96.
Madam Chair, members, both bills are...
Counsel, excuse me. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, before we leave the property tax, we did adopt a little provision on job Z on page 91. It was in both bills, and it was the same. I just want to make it clear that the Senate at some point is going to make a motion and try to convince the House to agree to take all references to job Z out of state law. So just want to make it clear. We'd grandfather in what currently exists, I think, in our Senate bill. So I wouldn't want anybody to presume because we've adopted a new job Z provision that don't read too much into that on the part of the Senate.
Duly noted.
Madam Chair, members, the provisions of the special taxes articles are the same with two exceptions. There are two provisions that were included in the House article that were not included in the Senate article. These are on the bottom of page 97 of the side-by-side, sections 8 and 9. And one modifies the tobacco products use tax, reducing the exemption for the tobacco products use tax from $100 worth of product to $50. And the second is the imposition of a consumer use tax on cigarettes.
Senator Bach, I think we can adopt the whole article if you like those provisions. If not, we can adopt everything but them.
Madam
Chair. What do you think? Representative Simpson.
Just a question on Section 8. So basically, you're saying from 2 cartons of cigarettes to 1?
Mr. Michael?
Tobacco products.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Simpson, this relates to cigars, snuff, pipe tobacco, and that sort of thing. Section 9 relates to the cigarette tax. So, it essentially reduces the amount of cigars, for example, to $50 without incurring use tax.
Wow, Senator Bach, we could expand the base right here. Finally. We're going the wrong way for years.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Bach.
Mr. Manson, the people pay use tax when they bring more than $100 of tobacco into the state. I'm wondering how much money we collect for the use tax on this provision. Do people even know they're supposed to pay?
Mr. Manson,
Madam Chair,
remind us what the de minimis is first. What do we get to?
Madam Chair and Senator Bach, well, the de minimis currently is $100 that you can bring in to the state without
paying the products. I mean, in total.
Pardon me?
This is separate bank.
You're talking about the $770?
Yeah. What is it, 770?
That's on the general sales tax, sales and use tax. This is the cigarette excise tax. But anyway, the rationale for dropping that from, we don't collect a lot of use tax, and that's cigarettes or other products as well. But But anyway, the rationale from dropping this to $50 is to kind of make it equate to the tax rate that's on cigarettes. So it's kind of bringing it down. So it's kind of comparable amount of other tobacco products value versus cartons of cigarettes. So that's kind of the rationale behind lowering that. Then in the second one, the cigarette consumer use tax in Section 9, that was just an oversight. When we moved it from retail up to the wholesale, that was inadvertently left off. So that's just more of a correction in Section 9 there.
Madam Chair, if we were to adopt this, and let's say the governor came in at the final hour and said, in 2005, I really wanted a dollar on the cigarette tax, not 75 cents. Would the train have left the station, or would we still be able to consider his request?
Senator Bach, I think we can always consider his request, but...
Certainly would be germane to the bill. Do we know what 25 cents would raise?
I think 25 cents would raise about $70 million a year.
It's close.
Mr. Manson? Or?
I think it is around $75 million a year, I believe.
65.
That was a quarter?
I voted against the Health and Human Service bill that had the tobacco fee in it. Matter of fact, I think all the Democratic members of the Tax Committee voted against the Health and Human Service bill that year because I think we objected to the idea. We thought it should have been carried in the tax bill, not in the health bill.
Senator Bach, I think I'm going to guess there were two no's over here and three yeses on health and human cigarette. Yes.
Actually, no, I was a yes. It was,
yes.
It was
yes.
One of the few health and human service bills.
I think I may have been a no, but
oh, maybe a no. I think Representative Simpson and Marquardt were no. Representative Dietrich, do you remember where you were?
Yes.
Yes, I was a yes. We're divided.
Madam Chair. Sure.
Representative Dabney.
I would like to argue for the House position, or for the Department's position here on Section 8, kind of aligning the way we treat other tobacco products with cigarettes just kind of makes sense. You do things one way.
Senator Bach, what do you think?
Senator Watt, did you vote no on the Health and Human Service bill?
I did.
Senator Sway?
I was a no vote.
Representative Larson, you were in the House at the time. Remember, you voted yes.
But I think he would have voted no if he was in the Senate.
So, Senator Bach, how did it pass?
We're very.
I think in the House we had, I think it was about 50-50, Republicans and Democrats, with Republicans providing a few more votes than Democrats for the final solution. It was just about 50-50, wasn't it? So, how did it pass? How did it pass the Senate?
Senator Marty doesn't remember. But clearly, there are three members of the Senate Tax Committee who voted no on that provision. We thought it belonged in the tax bill.
But, Madam Chair, it sounds like that was more a process question.
Good policy.
Senator Ma.
Madam Chair, you may recall that was the year. Was that the year where we had a duck call in the tax conference committee?
Oh, what?
Quack, quack.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Senator Wow, you might have to bring that back.
I may have to bring that back. But I think, Madam Chair, that was the year, right?
So too.
Senator Skoy, do you recall that?
Your memory is very good, Senator Wow.
Yes. And I was sitting in this chair, I think. And, Madam Chair, you were across from me.
Yes?
Yes.
That might be back.
Madam Chair, I just want to make sure the governor doesn't lose some flexibility at the end of the session, that if he were to come to us and suggest that to close this up we need an extra quarter, we'd be willing to consider his request that we hadn't adopted all the tobacco that we're going to do.
So, Senator Bach, you're comfortable with the House article, but you would rather take these two provisions and not include them at this time. Is that right?
Madam Chair, I'm fine with including them. I just would like to make sure that that we're able to accommodate the governor in the event that he wants to do something on tobacco to close the session. But I'm fine with adopting them as long as the committee understands. We have an agreement that we may have to come back to it, requested by the governor.
Everybody comfortable with that? Makes sense. So, Senator Bach, is it fair to say then that you're going to move to adopt the House article and include the provisions on tobacco products and cigarette use tax not included in the Senate bill? Is that your motion? Okay, so Senator Bach makes that motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay.
No.
No. The motion prevails. Wow, you do have.
They're very principled, Madam Chair.
That's very nice. We're all going to get pretty principled in a while. okay, Ms. Zoff, we're doing well here. We're down to the last one.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the final recommendation is that we would pull, I believe it's just 9 sections out of what had been the department miscellaneous proposal that are identical in both bills, and those would be starting on page 100 of the side-by-side. It's sections 4 through 7 of the House Article 14, the miscellaneous article. And then on page 102, and those all have to deal with the department's function as a debt collection, their debt collection function. And then on page 102 of the side-by-side would be House sections 11 through 15 that are the same in both bills.
A discussion on either one of those bullets seems pretty straightforward. Is there, does anyone have a concern about doing that? If not, I will move the first one. First bullet, House Article 14, sections 4 to 7, Senate Article 16, sections 10 to 13 on page 100 of the side-by-side. Discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. And Senator Bach will move House Article 14, sections 11 to 15, Senate Article 15, sections 1 to 3, Article 16, sections 19, 20, page 102 of the side-by-side. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Say nay. The motion prevails. Thank you, Ms. Knopf and Mr. Michael. I know they seem small at times, but they took a lot of work for Mr. Michael and Ms. Knopf to really narrow down all these provisions and work it out for all of us, and we really appreciate that. But with that, Senator Bach, is the testifier wanted to come here? Otherwise, we can just start the next article until they get here.
I don't see him yet, Madam Chair.
Okay. I believe we got up to economic development. What page we were on. Is someone... Senator Bach, if this sounds okay to everybody, we'll go to page 52, Article 7, Economic Development. Start working through the side-by-side, and we can always go back to that aggregate issue. So I think we're going to start with Job Z. Is that Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sections 1 and 2 of the House bill essentially allow disclosure of private data, first on unemployment insurance and secondly tax return data to the state auditor for the purpose of allowing or facilitating these Job Z audits that the legislature mandated 2 years ago that are to be done by the Office of the State Auditor. Section 3 modifies the property tax of the House bill modifies the property tax exemption for Job Z properties. present law subjects these properties to pre-existing school operating referenda levies. What the House bill does is to subject them to all school operating referenda. So voter-approved referenda after the job Z, after designation of the zone would now subject these to tax. I think that for the current taxes payable year, that would raise about $100,000 of additional revenue or tax on those properties.
The Senate bill doesn't, the tax bill does not include a provision that addresses that, but there is a provision in the E-12 bill that exempts the Job Z properties from the operating referendum levies, but would subject them to the debt service levies. And just to go back a little bit, the Senate doesn't include many of the other Job Z modifications because the Senate provision on Job Z would terminate the availability of the Job Z treatment unless the business subsidy agreement had been entered into before May 1st of this year.
Senator Brock? So you guys are going to let it phase out, eliminate, but the E-12 bill, do you sit on that committee? No.
No, but Madam Chair, there are current Job Z projects out there that have the designation for a number of years, so what that E-12 provision would do was that if a new building referendum was passed, it would apply then to existing projects that are already under the Job Z provisions, because we grandfather the current ones in. Council, is that correct? That all that would work?
Mr. Chair, I would have to take a look at the effective date on that, but I believe you're right. I'll double check on the effective date of the K-12 provision.
Senator Moss?
Madam Chair, I wanted to move to, I want to talk about different subjects. So, okay. The data provisions, sections 1 and 2, did the data privacy group in the Judiciary Committee have a chance to take a look at this section, Madam Chair?
I don't remember that we had any testimony on that. Maybe Representative Simpson or Carlson remembers. I don't recall that. We were responding to the state auditor who 2 years ago the legislature required to do these audits. And they say they need this information to do the audits. So I don't recall. Do you, Representative Marquardt, or anyone else that we had?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Do you recall any testimony from the data privacy folks on
no.
this issue? Mr. Manson, have you heard from anybody on this?
Madam Chair, no, I haven't.
Senator Wong.
Madam Chair, I'm going to take a look at this and perhaps talk to Senate Counsel, who is the counsel for the data practice group, to just see if this is okay. It might very well be, because usually when we have data that's classified as private data in one agency and it's given to another agency, it continues to have that. But I just want to make sure that we put the appropriate protections in place.
Thank you. I think that's a good idea. And we didn't discuss it at all. So thank you. Representative Simpson.
Madam Chair, I think that I'd like to just have a little discussion about Job Z and the Section 15 on the Senate side. I think that there's quite a difference of opinion on the House side as to where we are with Job Z and where we'd like to see it go compared to what the Senate is proposing on their side of the aisle. I think we have a good track record of support on the House side for Job Z and would like to see the continuation. There are others. There are some in our House side would even like to see it extended. We've had a lot of discussion over on the House side, especially just I believe last night, Representative Rukavina had a long discussion about getting dollars back into the mineral funds so that they could continue with the RRRB funds to do projects in the economic development field. And I feel that the Job Z in our rural areas, in our ag areas, and so have been kind of our mineral fund or our triple RB fund. So I would certainly encourage the Senate to think long and hard before they would really want to adopt this, because we have had successes in this. And I have to admit that I'm sure there are people that have done some things that have maybe not been exactly as was hoped to be done when this project was started. But I think there's been a lot of tightening of the job Z, there's been a lot of changes made, and it is good for rural Minnesota. And I think that's what this group is about, is all of Minnesota. I think Senator Mao has made that comment a few times, one Minnesota, and I would like this committee to keep that in mind as they move forward.
Senator Buck.
Madam Chair, as the Senate author of the Job Z bill in 2003, there was very clear legislative intent, and in fact, I believe it's in law, that the commissioner is to designate Job Z parcels of land in economically distressed areas of the state. And whether the legislature wasn't clear enough with the words, but somehow we're getting an awful lot of Job Z projects approved in areas that I think most of us in this room think are not economically distressed areas of the state. And if we're going to continue going down that path, I feel pretty strongly that it's not doing what it was legislatively intended to. And I guess I don't want to continue providing those kind of incentives to regions that are economically doing just fine and on the grow, and there's a state cost to doing this. I'm just not sure in a lot of areas whether this made any difference whether a project happened or not. Some area, like Senator Langseth, there's a Marco makes an argument that there's a couple of projects that it may have made a difference of in his district because of the border issue, and there might have been some flight issue across the border. and I understand that issue. But I remain concerned, and maybe we can have some discussion with the department later before we close the bill up and see what.
Senator Bach, I think it's fair to say the House, as Representative Simpson has indicated, is divided on, and we've got the House Tax Committee members. Some want to eliminate it, some want to expand it like the governor, and some want to keep it but make it more accountable, and I think the House's position is reflective of the House as a whole. And so the House is not looking to eliminate Job Z. On the other hand, it is looking to tighten it, and I think some of the issues you've raised are legitimate. I received from the Center for Rural Policy and Development a letter that probably every conferee got, and it says that I'm writing about Job Z and that they began researching and monitoring this program in 2004. You know, my recollection is this organization, we can go back and look, but I think when Job Z was being debated, and I will admit I was a strong opponent, I think they actually came out against it. But we have to go back and look. At any rate, they're for it now, and they're a nonpartisan research institute. I assume our rural members are more familiar with this Center for Rural Policy and Development than I am. But anyhow, in this letter it says, overall, I believe it is fair to say that the program has helped to stimulate job growth and capital investment in many rural Minnesota communities. Yes, this job stimulation has been geographically uneven, as you've stated, with some communities receiving significant benefits while others receiving little or none. Our data and reports clearly document that, but to be perfectly honest, if one thought about it carefully, this was to be expected. And Senator Bach, did you expect that? Because I think part of the, I'd be interested to know as the author what you thought. I mean, I remember Representative Magnus carrying this, and I've noted that there's been a lot of discussion of late that what would probably be a big help to rural Minnesota is broadband access. And, you know, I just, I have to say, since I was such a strong opponent, you know, maybe can you tell me further what you thought was going to happen?
Well, Madam Chair, I never thought I'd be sitting here 4 years later. I mean, I thought that it was tailor-made for northeastern Minnesota. I thought it would be the provision that UPM Kamimini paper from Helsinki, Finland, they would take it to their board of directors and say, this is what the state of Minnesota is willing to do if we build an $800 million paper machine in Grand Rapids. This is what they're willing to do for us. And I thought it was a big carrot. And I saw it on their PowerPoint presentation that they took to Helsinki, Finland. And they did try to promote it. But paper machine hasn't been built. They didn't make a decision to go ahead with the environmental permitting. And I'd feel a little different if that had happened. But I certainly never thought that I'd be sitting here 4 years later and the two highest profile projects that have been done, that one would be in Wyoming, Minnesota, and one would be in North Branch, Minnesota. And I don't think there's one person in this room that thinks those are economically distressed areas of the state. And those are the poster childs, both very good Minnesota companies. But that, as the author, certainly wasn't my intent. And it certainly wasn't my intent that one of those companies could create 70-some jobs in one of those cities and cut 400 in another place in Minnesota and still qualify for Job Z in the outgoing years on the facility built just north of the Twin Cities. It's just not what I thought was going to happen, that you could qualify for Job Z, add 70 jobs, and then down the road, in an hour's commute, you could eliminate 400 and then maintain your Job Z status on your new facility for, you know, the balance of the 12 years. In my wildest dreams, as a Senate author, I didn't think that was going to happen. And I never thought, looking, we had the department in to do a little overview of it, and I looked at the scatter graph of the state of where all the projects happened, and maybe I was totally naive, but I certainly didn't think so many were going to happen in Stearns County and in Olmsted County. And boy, you know, I don't know those areas as well as some of you maybe, but I first blush for me, and maybe I need to drive there, I have a difficult time believing that Olmsted County and Stearns County are economically distressed. Now, maybe we can look at the census numbers, you know, from 1980, 1990, 2000, and maybe they are like some of the counties Senator Skoy and I represent, where population is declining and has been declining. And I think population growth is probably a pretty good measure of what's happening economically in a county, in a rural county. And I don't know what's happening in Stearns County or in Olmsted County relative to census population data, but I was just going to make a guess, the little bit I know, they're probably not declining. There's probably pretty good economic growth happening there. So I think when the department kind of tells us about the successes, and they seem to focus a lot on North Branch and Wyoming and the cluster of projects in Olmsted and the cluster of projects in Stearns, as the author is not doing what I thought it was going to do, what I intended to do.
Senator Bach, I think as we move further through the side-by-side, there's a number of provisions you'll like, because the moving, we call it the pirating of Job Z from one community to another, we tried to tighten that up, and we also felt that the deed was doing things with parcels that they were never allowed to do, and we're tightening that up, but that comes further in the side-by-side. I think you'll be interested in those. Representative Marquardt.
Well, you know, I've had different views on all of this. I mean, I do think anything you can put in as incentives help rural Minnesota, and I think there's no doubt it has helped rural Minnesota. I didn't vote for it in 2003 because it was part of a tax bill that cut local government aid by $150 million. And quite frankly, while I like the I liked the program Job-Z. I really felt what it did to rural Minnesota was I'm going to take 50-some million dollars of LGA out of rural Minnesota with this hand, and watch this one. Here's the Job-Z. I'm going to give you $8-9 million here. And I saw it as a huge net loser for rural Minnesota in that respect, and quite frankly, thought it was the administration's effort to somewhat mask what they were doing with LGA, and that now is costing rural Minnesota $100 million a year if you take the inflation that was in it. So in my mind, the number one economic tool we have in rural Minnesota small cities is local government aid, because that keeps property taxes down, your services up, and keeps residents there. The concerns I have, and I think we're addressing some of those, is that after the first year, that Office of Rural Development had done a study and kind of looked at the program, and 60% of all the initial expansions or relocations, 60% had occurred within 25 miles where they had moved or expanded, which showed that, in fact, you saw some of this just switching among cities, and it probably wasn't benefiting one area greatly over the net impact probably wasn't much of anything. And then also the same study showed that the larger the city that you were, the more likely you were to have a Job-Z. And the assumption, which is very accurate, is that the regional centers, for example, that already have much of the infrastructure in place or new industry and that type of thing, is going to have a huge advantage over these small communities. And what I've seen in my area is the regional centers have received most of these, but the truly distressed areas have not. And you're exactly right, Senator Bach, in that initially it was set up, they're going to pick about 10 most distressed areas. But politically they couldn't do that, because then there would have been too many winners or losers. So then they just created 10 huge areas. But if your assumption is that all of rural Minnesota is extremely distressed, then it was the correct thing to do. But as a representative who has the largest city in the district I represent is 7,600 Detroit Lakes, all the way down to the city of Tenney that has 6 residents, you didn't provide a lot of benefit for a lot of the small cities, if any at all. So we tended to, in a way, I think, create a little bit of a disparity within rural Minnesota. And so I would not support eliminating this, because I do think that anything is beneficial and there's offshoot even outside the regional centers. But I do like what we've done in the House plan in trying to limit this moving from one city to the next that isn't too far away and hurting one at the expense of the other. But I think it's worthy of looking at it and making restrictions. But I think we for sure have to give it more time and see what happens.
Senator
Representative Lenchowski, Senator Moore, did you vote for the 2003 tax bill in the Senate?
I don't remember, Mr. Chair. If it was a cut to LGA, I think that I did not vote for it. I have to go back and look. I don't think I voted for it.
So, Marco, how much did it cut LGA?
Senator Bach, from $587 million down to $437 million long term. So, and then in 2005, we did restore $48 million of that $150. So right now we're $102 million down, $485 million.
I didn't vote.
Senator Scoid, did you vote for the 2001 tax bill?
I didn't vote for the 2001 or the 2002.
Chair here didn't vote for the 2003 bill. Senator Marty, did you vote for the 2003 tax bill?
I don't think I did. Nor did I vote for the 99 or the 2000.
Senator Marty, are we going to be able to get your vote for this one?
Might.
Representative Simpson? You wanted to speak to Job-Z?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Senator Bach, I certainly respect the position you're taking on this and your thoughts and your thoughtfulness of the program. And it kind of goes back to, I don't think you throw the baby out with the bathwater when you have situations that arise. The two companies that you talked about Should have they put it, been put into those areas? Are they depressed areas? Well, I think all of us would question that, and I think that's why you've seen tightening of the there's been changes made as we've came forward every year, and I think there's some more changes being made here. But in rural Minnesota, in the areas that I live, the areas that Paul's at and stuff, I mean, I think Mr. Geller in this comment here, he says clearly some of this is diminishing of the program as appropriate, but my question is, if not jobs, then what? And I think that's kind of the whole thing. If we're not going to do this program, what are we going to do for rural Minnesota? And what are we going to do to continue encouraging jobs out there? The one thing that I've said all along is that we take a small community, and if we can bring a company into a small community that employs 10, 15, 20 people, we'll just about bend over backwards to do that because they have children, they move into the communities. Our schools are struggling. We're facing declining enrollment. So it's a constant struggle out there. We see situations here in the seven-county metro area where we have a company that wants to expand by 2,000 people, and it's questioned. Do we want the traffic? Do we want the congestion? Well, again, rural Minnesota will do anything to get 10 or 20 jobs, no different than in where you live. And so are there times when these programs are taken advantage of? Absolutely. But I think that's where we come into play to make sure we tighten the provisions up. But I certainly don't think we throw them out. So.
Senator Brock.
Madam Chair, maybe you could ask your House conferees if they voted for the 2003 tax bill. Or would you like me to ask them?
Whatever you'd like. I don't know that everyone always can remember. I'm sitting here thinking about it myself. I think I was a yes.
Senator Bach, I voted for the 2003 tax bill, and I voted for it on the pretense we had a $4.2 or $4.3 billion deficit, and it was the answer to get us out of here. Was it the right thing to do? At the time, I think it was.
Representative Larson, how about you? 2003 tax bill?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson?
No, and I've been hitting a lot of red buttons until this year. now I'm back on the green as we're addressed this morning.
Representative Daphne, 2003 tax bill?
I think that was proudly no. And I'm not as proud as voting against the 2001 tax bill. That was, I still count that as probably the toughest vote that I've taken in now 7 years here. But I think every time I look back on the impact of the 2001 property tax changes, I'm more and more confident that that was the right vote, and I'm sorry I didn't speak out against it as well.
I made a mistake in the 2001 tax bill. It baited me with a rebate. Remember the rebate? Mm-hmm. I mean, the Jesse checks? A lot of people were.
That traveled separately.
A lot of people were baited by that.
In 01, too.
In 01, but I think it traveled separately, didn't it? See, that's why I think it's hard to remember, really.
Hardly anybody. 11 or 13.
He had, wasn't it in 01 that, at least for the House conferees, and Senator Larson was there? I think, what was the year of the Pew Amendment? It gave the income tax cut more to the middle class. Was that 99?
I'm sure
that
was 1999.
99, see? So we had a lot of things going on in the House. Representative Pugh added an amendment to heavy load the income tax cut to the middle bracket. And it changed the vote. I think it passed almost everybody.
Representative did a lot of props there.
Yes. Actually, I think Representative Simpson might remember. I don't know if he was here. Representative or Senator Larson, maybe you remember. I think what happened is it was such a surprise amendment that I believe Speaker Spigum and Representative Abrams, we stayed quiet on the floor for over an hour while they figured out how to deal with it, and they ultimately accepted it. They all voted for it. That's kind of my memory. Is that what you think happened, Senator Larson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think that was one of the nights that I remember the entire House being swept away with itself.
Yeah.
That's what I recall. Senator Bach was there as well.
I remember it.
Well, Senator Bach, the first 2 years that I was in the House with you, the year that Governor Senator Scoy and I and Senator Larson came in with Governor Ventura. We were that class. He was our first governor, and it's when we had the House was offering income tax rebates, and we changed them to sales tax rebates. And I think we probably all voted for that, would be my guess.
I think
it's hard to remember it all.
My recollection is correct. Senator Johnson, along with Senate counsel, cooked up the sales tax rebate scheme from something they saw happen in Colorado. And Governor Ventura grabbed onto it and claimed it to be his idea, but I believe it came out of the Senate Tax Committee. And the issue was whether the people that receive those checks are going to be subject to income tax
yes.
liability on them. And the Senate found the wisdom to do a sales tax rebate to avoid income tax liability. Council, is that accurate?
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that's accurate, except it wasn't me. Sorry to say. It was, I think, Keith probably. You guys worked on that.
The House was, House Democrats were in on that, too. House majority was pushing the income.
Mr. Michael, was 99 the year of the tripartite solution?
2000.
Is that 2000?
Third, or whatever.
That idea came out of the Senate also.
You don't want to claim that one, do you?
I think it happened on about the 29th of June, and we have waited a state government shutdown, if I remember right.
We had a deficit.
That was the gift and the shift and gimmick thing, wasn't it? No, that was license tabs for the governor.
The governor got license tabs. And the Senate got
all paying for it now.
Got a takeover of school excess levies. So the Senate got education spending, and the House got income tax reductions.
Yeah, I think that's right. Was it? Oh, you weren't here.
That's right.
I think that's right.
That's right.
I think I've heard about the 2001 session about to the point where I've had about enough of it. I can't be blamed.
That's a good position to be in.
Madam Chair, I go back in history on tax votes and so on. I can also revisit the Oleo Margarine debate, taxed or not. I was on the tax committee in those days.
Oleo Margarine. Should it be taxed?
There can be a lot of, Madam Chair, history that could be talked about with tax bills through the years. Talk about a metro-rural regional split. Seriously.
Yeah.
Oleo?
Well, we had a tax, Madam Chair, on oleo margarine. And, it pitted the various farm interests against one another. You know, the dairy farmers on one side of the issue, and those who raised corn and soybeans on another side of the issue. And you wouldn't believe how that erupted in the House Tax Committee. Visual displays of what was a fraud, what was not a fraud, because oleo margarine had to be non-colored at that point if it was sold in Minnesota without a special tax. I don't mean to digress too far. I just wanted to point out that we're visiting all these votes that one took at one time or other.
Carlson,
some of us can go back away.
I've been told that long ago people would buy margarine, and then they would buy a little dye packet to turn it yellow. Is that true?
Madam Chair, it was in the packet. And you would squeeze the packet, and you would drink that little dye. And as a kid growing up, and my folks used oleo margarine, five children, you know, it was a little less expensive. One of my tasks when they would come back from the grocery store was to sit there and squeeze that to get
That's
the
amazing.
Color through.
Madam
then
Chair.
They allowed the yellow to be
Did
sold
you know that?
If... they had a special tax, if I recall. I think it was 10 cents a pound or something.
15. Madam Chair.
Senator Simpson.
Being in the retail grocery business for a while, I had dairy farmers refuse to come in our store if we had oleo margarine in the store.
Senator Bach, this is discussions making the dairy credit in our bill look really good, isn't it?
Madam Chair, Representative Diedrich and I are learning a great deal.
Madam Chair.
Does
Representative Carlson or Representative Simpson know what your margarine was
legalized in Minnesota?
Because I know there was a period of time where it was illegal to sell.
I remember the distinction between colored and colored. I don't remember when it wasn't sold, but I do remember this. Went down to Iowa. If you were coming back into Minnesota, there were small stores that would have flats full of colored and people would buy these full cases and bring them back into Minnesota. So those border issues, right, like you're running.
I remember the color thing, but not the time.
I remember as a child an old dairy magazine of some sort with my mother on the cover, because she had somehow been involved in busting folks coming across the line with margarine.
That's amazing.
She was a farm girl, and butter was the way to go. Now, when she became a mother later on, it was all margarine all the time. But she was involved in efforts to block the illegal transfer of oleomargarine to Minnesota.
Now we know Representative Dabney's activist roots are from Oleo, Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, is the House leading us down the path that
dairy,
the dairy industry is in big trouble because Oleo is taking over? Displacing butter? Are we being set up here for the dairy credit?
Senator Scoy.
Madam Chair, in an effort to try to move us on, I'm going to
tell we appreciate.
A story about a resort that went out of business up in my district, and one of my folks' good friends, Buster Spaulding, bought this small resort. It was three cabins and a fish cleaning house. He put up a big sign, and it said, Buster's Oleo Acres, a cheap spread. But the resort that went out of business, we really should take a good hard look at what we're doing there. I've been looking at the House provisions. The Senate Sorts. Has some provisions on resorts.
Get group going on that, too. Senator Bach, yes, you've got an old blue book
Council.
There.
As long as we're reminiscing, Council. Representative Carlson, is your phone number still 6-4255?
That's correct. How far did you go back there?
You had pretty dark looking hair back then.
Can we
see
a picture?
I think the committee, Madam Chair, would enjoy seeing a picture of Representative Carlson. He's got the same phone number to say. Some other things have changed, but the same phone number. Madam Chair?
Madam Chair,
you look about the same, really.
Yeah.
There was a big argument at one time when we were changing offices whether we could keep the same phone number back in those days.
That's why I was curious.
Yeah. Those of us that wanted to keep the same number for a variety of reasons finally prevailed.
Look at that.
What year, Madam Chair? What year is that?
The 75, 76?
It'll be the 74 election, but that might be your 72 picture.
75, 76, I was crossing the Mekong River from Laos into Thailand, living in the refugee camp.
Representative Carlson was here at the legislature.
And a high school teacher at the time who taught some of my cohorts as the first groups in the late 1970s who came to the United States as students in Minneapolis.
Edison High School, Madam Chair. We had a very large ESL program.
Mm-hmm.
About 40% or more of our students in any given year came from around the world.
Even then.
Many of them were Hmong heritage. In fact, I think that was our largest group of Hmong.
Thank you for that. Well, while we pass the picture around... It's a good picture.
Yeah. Well, I hope it is.
It sure is. We'll get to you.
That's some sideburns.
Report. Are we on? Are we still on page 52? At the bottom here. Is that where we're at? Where do we leave off? Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Section 4 of the House bill requires qualified businesses under the Jobs E program annually to report to the Commissioner of Revenue, the essentially a tabulation of the tax benefits that they received in the previous year. And there are essentially, if they fail to submit that report, they could lose their status as qualifying for Job Z tax incentives. Section 5 of the House bill is sort of the biennial allocation of $1.5 million to the Border City Enterprise Zones, the Moorhead, Dilworth, Breckenridge, East Grand Forks, Ordinville.
Madam Chair,
Senator Bach,
what are we going to do with provisions like this where we both have the same provision, we have the same amount of money? I suspect Representative Marquardt and Senator Langseth is a companion bill. So Marquardt, Senator Langseth, whose bill was it, yours or?
Representative Lanning carried it in the House.
But Madam Chair, once we get a target, what if they don't give us any money? How are we going to do things that are even identical?
Senator Bach.
$1.5 million. And I like this.
I think this is going to be tough because this is good policy and we do it all the time, and you could even argue it should just be permanent. But if our target's really small, I think everything's going to property tax relief. Well, that's going to make it hard to do anything but property tax relief. My guess. What do you think?
I think Senator Langseth, who's a member of the Tax Committee, would be very torn for his border city aid versus additional money for LGA for his cities. It would be a very difficult decision for him.
Well, we'll have to request that target again today. Mr. Michael.
Section 6 is one of a variety of provisions that came from the TIF technical bill, which was put together after the final version of that was put together after the Senate had already passed its tax bill. And this relates to the blight test for redevelopment districts. Under the present law, you can meet the blight test for a substandard building that the city financed or demolished itself before certifying the district. There are two parts to the blight test. One is the coverage test, which requires a certain portion of the parcels to actually be occupied by buildings. This allows the city to count one of these demolished substandard buildings as meeting the coverage part of the blight test, which is, you know, a relatively technical kind of a change. Section 7 is a sort of a conforming change to the renewal and renovation district blight test. Section 8 relates to the definition of small cities. These cities qualify for using economic development districts for retail and office type developments. Under current law, they have to have a population of 5,000 or less and be located 10 miles or more from a city with a population of 10,000. What the House bill does is say that if that 10-mile limit is essentially breached because the larger city has annexed territory, this typically occurs down in the Rochester area where Rochester continually keeps annexing its surrounding territory, that then the small city would have 10 years to continue their status as a small city, even though they no longer
still meet the 10-mile test.
Because the retroactive part
is.
Yeah,
it's a different thing. And, Madam Chair, the Senate, as an alternative to that, decided to simply exempt the cities of Elgin, Iota, Byron, and Orinoco from that mileage restriction. They are the cities near the city of Rochester that came into conflict with this definition because of the expansion of the borders of the city of Rochester.
Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey brought me an issue earlier this week about a TIF, I believe, that was adopted, I think, in 2003.
Yes.
And I think it's in the town of Spicer, who I believe is ineligible because they're within the 10 miles of Wilmer.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a TIF there, and under law, I don't believe they're supposed to have one. And they've had it since 2003. Don't know for sure how we all of a sudden discovered this. Senator, Michael, do you know?
Senator Bach and Representative Junkie raised something with me as well, and I don't think we've quite figured it out. And last we left it, we were going to ask the city of Spicer to contact Mr. Michael, and I don't know if that's happened.
Madam Chair, I've had a couple of conversations with officials from the city of Spicer. The reason it was discovered was the Office of the State Auditor, I think, sent them a notice of noncompliance with the law. And the situation there is apparently their TIF consultant told them they could create one of these districts on the assumption that they were more than 10 miles away from Wilmer. The reality is, from what the official there told me, they're only 5.2 miles away from Wilmer. There was some question about whether if you did it by road miles it might qualify, but apparently the person told me that's not true either.
You mean if they went into MapQuest and it came out at 10?
Well, that doesn't, apparently that doesn't work. But anyway, they, relying on their TIF consultant, essentially just created this economic development district, and now the state auditor in their usual, you know, compliance stuff has found them. So they're in a somewhat difficult situation, I guess you would care as it is.
Madam Chair, Mr. Michael, if we didn't fix this, is the TIF consultant liable if the city of Spicer were to take them to court?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, very interesting question. I don't know whether there's this particular TIF consultant is neither a lawyer nor an accountant. And so I don't know whether there are any malpractice sorts of liability for that, and if, you know, there could be, I don't know that there's a sort of a standard of care and a tort, you know, malpractice kind of liability for this people in this kind of business. So I would hazard to express an opinion about that.
You know, Senator Bach, when we keep going, Faribault has a, not this exact situation, but another situation where they'd like more TIF, and they were supposed to decertify, and they have money sitting in the TIF district, and they're not supposed to do that, and I believe the state auditor did that once before. So I think it's for ease. These kind of issues are a problem when people don't follow the rules. Do you say, oops, and fix it for them, and then just encourage them? I mean, it sends a message statewide that get into trouble. Well, legislature will just pass a special law for you. I mean, I don't think we want to do that. We've got a couple of these, and they're always difficult. So I don't know what we do.
Kind of like passing that local option sales tax referendum and coming to the legislature.
At least that, though, they're not in violation of the law. Senator Ron.
Madam Chair, can Mr. Michaels go back to the change to the calculation of distance in the small cities and explain? I'm looking at the actual language that's in the bill, and it's a little bit hard to, I can't quite get it.
Mr. Michael, we actually had a diagram from Representative Welty in the Tax Committee with the state and the circle and Rochester and 10 miles around it, and then who qualifies. Very helpful.
Madam Chair, is the way the language is crafted is to address that particular situation, or is this going to be open to interpretation for other instances?
Well, we can have Mr. Michael go over it. I should tell you that we found out we were working on an amendment during the omnibus tax bill day on the floor, and Representative Dabney was one of the members of the TIF working group in the House. It appeared that Representative Welty thought our language maybe didn't even work in the end for his community. And we were working to... Okay, so maybe Mr. Michael can tell us about that, but we were actually going to try to go back and even change the language we've got. But the minority Republicans, Representative Simpson, surprised us and withdrew 88 amendments. We had no amendments, and we were on third reading just all at once. So we never got to clean this up. But there are issues here. Maybe Mr. Michael can take a minute and go through them.
Madam Chair, Senator Maugh, to explain the way the House language works is it allows the city to use any set of boundaries for the larger city during the previous 10 years. So it effectively, in the situation in Rochester, what's happening is Rochester, I don't know if they do this every year, but they frequently are making annexations, which move their boundaries out and move them closer to these smaller cities. And so what the House language does is it says, well, you can go back and if you can qualify using a boundary for the larger city at some point during this last 10 years, then you can qualify as a small city. And this is intended to cover the situation. I think it's Eota, which is about 8 miles or something like that from Rochester now, but at some point 7 or 8 years ago was actually 10 miles away. So in making their determination, they could go back and say, well, we're going to use the boundaries of Rochester that were in place in 1998 or 1999. And under those boundaries, we satisfy the 10-mile rule. And the way the law works is it's the boundary that's, or it's your status when you approve the tax increment district that's the relevant boundary for the entire duration. Now, what the chair indicated, what we found out was there's really only one city in Rochester that apparently, of these four, that really are lost their status because of the annexation. The reality is, like, Orinoco is only 3 miles away from Rochester, and Byron's 5 miles away. It's the legislators that were involved, once they decided to try to qualify this one city, then the other city said, well, we need to be small cities, too. And so that, and in fact, Representative Welty was very upfront about this, and he had a bill. His bill actually said, you qualify as a small city so long as your boundary doesn't touch the city that has a population of 10,000. So in that case, something like Falcon Heights would not qualify, I think, because its boundary touches St. Paul. But if there's some distance between the smaller city and the larger city, even an inch, I suppose, they would qualify under Representative Welty's bill. So that's why the chair is indicating this language really probably doesn't work for those four cities in Rochester, because I think maybe in the case of Eota this would give them a couple of years, because apparently these boundaries were done back in the in the late 90s that moved Rochester out. So,
well, Madam Chair, I'm sympathetic to the small cities that are trying to get the status, and I, no disrespect to the staff who are working very hard to craft language to help them address this situation, but just sounds like it's an awfully convoluted way to go about making good policy. I think we, at the end, maybe the straight-up exemption in the Senate language is the way to go, without putting something in the law that's going to require this much explanation. Mr. Michael is going to be getting lots of calls from TIF lawyers and TIF people to interpret this. I think it's hard to understand what this really is saying.
Well, and on that, I think, in an effort to do good policy, with no offense to either the House or Senate provisions here, we probably shouldn't do either. and I don't think we're in a position to do that now, but, Senator Bach and for all the countries, I think it's worth Mr. Michael taking another couple minutes to explain the history of this small city thing anyhow, because This is TIF for retail, folks. This is TIF for retail. So this was happened. It was taken away, and it was brought back. So maybe Mr. Michael can just give us the history of TIF for retail. Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just to take a walk down history lane here. When the TIF Act was passed in 1979, it created the authority to use tax increment for economic development. Before that, TIF was largely sort of a redevelopment blight correction kind of a tool. And that economic development district authority basically said a city could create an economic development district on any site for any kind of business if it concluded that that provided either jobs or tax base for the city. What happened during the 1980s, though, was that there were a fair number of these economic development districts that were done for things like retail and office on greenfield sites. Legislators in both the House and the Senate became concerned, more in the House than the Senate. But in the late 80s, there were a variety of restrictions that were enacted, culminating in the 1990s, in the 1990 bill that said you cannot, well, and some of the examples that came forward was there were suburbs that used TIF for a McDonald's restaurant, I remember the hearings on this, and a Cub food store on bare land greenfield sites. And so now Senator Rest had a bill that said this is not an appropriate use because largely those developments are determined by where the customers of those facilities are located. And so she limited in her bill the use of tax increment to only manufacturing, warehousing, and research and development on the theory that those are the kind of facilities that actually could locate in Wisconsin or Illinois or something like that, and so it might be appropriate to give them sort of tax incentives for greenfield sites for development. So that passed into law into the 1990s. And a sort of a delayed reaction, basically initially by Senator Bernhagen and then by others, there was an argument that in rural Minnesota, they oftentimes needed this incentive to help build retail facilities because those communities simply lacked access to services. And oftentimes they would be willing to provide a tax incentive to have a grocery store or a hardware store, or even I can remember instances saying a convenience store is something that's important enough for us because we don't want, our residents don't want to drive 15 miles to go to the regional center to buy their food or whatever. And so that debate went on for a long time, and finally in 1997 this provision was enacted. And it was supported largely by the League of Small Cities, and they argued for a provision essentially like what Representative Welty is proposing now, which was any city with 5,000 or less could use TIF for sort of modest-sized retail and office developments. Legislators, again, it was, I think at the time it was in the House, it was Dee Long and Ann Rest, were concerned about that, and so they said, well, wait a minute, that could lead to communities very close to each other having different rules. And so their sort of rough compromise was to say there has to be at least this 10-mile gap. And so that's where we're at with this provision.
Senator Bach, I'm amazed how much Mr. Michael knows about these subjects. We're very fortunate in the House, and I know you are fortunate in the Senate as well with Ms. Soff and your staff, but I think the few minutes on history there is helpful because I think the original TIF laws in 1979 are things that no one would ever want to go back to. And in fact, look at us. In 2001, the state of Minnesota got out of the business of TIF and stopped covering for the schools because it was costing us so much. We'd hate to go back to that. Where would we find the money for that?
I think it was over $100 million a year. Michael, is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, we, House Research used to do regular estimates of that in the 90s, and it was
around $100 million a year or in excess of that. For
you know, and Senator Bach, we have people who come to the House Tax Committee and try to tell us that TIF is not a tax subsidy with a straight face. I don't know if you get that in the Senate, but we get that in the House, that it's not somebody else paying their taxes. Tax increment financing at its core is a subsidy. And, you know, a lot of us aren't fans of subsidies. Some in the House are. But tax increment financing at its core is a property tax subsidy paid for by someone else for a business. And, you know, the House is trying to be as restrictive as it can in providing these subsidies. So I don't know how we get out of this small city TIF one, but we might need to all, in addition to talking to Spicer, learning more, I think we need to have folks maybe here who want to try to figure this out, because I don't know the solution. Do you have any thoughts on it?
Well, I like the current law. But having said that, Spicer has a problem. And Senator Lynch would like to do something. And whether that's the language of the House side or the Senate side, I don't know. I think we have to keep working on it. I share your concern, though, on the Spicer situation. And I've known people that have done it, for example, relative to planning and zoning. You know, you kind of know you won't get a permit, so you go and build the addition anyway. And then it's easier to ask for forgiveness. And it might cost an extra couple hundred bucks, but in the end, you got where you wanted to be, and you wouldn't have got there the other way. I sure hate to open that door relative to TIF projects. So I think we have to be very, much as we might like to help Spicer, we have to be very careful about that.
Well, we'll just keep thinking. Let's folks feel it all around this table that they'd like to grow TIF uses. Maybe there's one of us here, but I don't know who that is. I think we have to look. Senator Marty, no. I'm pretty sure he doesn't want to grow. Senator Marty once sent me the jackets to eliminate all TIF. And I think I signed them and threw them in, or I can't remember what I did.
I think you signed one that was a pure repeal of it. I also had one that was to allow cities to make the same subsidies, but sort of a truth in subsidies where they couldn't use TIF to do it because they make it sound like free money.
Right.
They could make the same subsidy, but they'd be doing it through the appropriation process. They'd, of course, be made more than whole because it's just a choice paid for themselves.
I think, Senator Marty, that was a great point that was being made, you know, before the stakeout out of the TIF business with the schools. That would have been a huge revenue raiser for the state of Minnesota to just repeal TIF. And now, if we could repeal it, which we won't, but if we could, every city and county who's using it would get a tax break. By repealing TIF, they'd stop paying corporate subsidies to all these folks who need TIF districts, I guess. So we won't end up going there, but I think while the legislature might, as a whole, may not be very interested in TIF, it is the work of the tax committees and the tax committee members. I think bipartisanly in both bodies understand that at its core, TIF is a subsidy from residents to someone else. So I think I think it should be clear to anybody who's tracking these that nobody around this table is looking to grow TIF. So we have to be careful. Mr. Michael.
Sections 9 and 11 of the House bill were a bill that Representative Mulry authored that allows development authorities and cities approving tax increment districts as part of the initial plan approval to delay when they will collect their first increment by up to 4 years. This authority does not apply to economic development districts, but to the other types of districts. The rationale for this is usually the first year or two of increment tends to be a very small amount. And of course, the duration limits are key to how many years of increment you've collected, so this would allow essentially collection of more increment over the same period.
period of year is the same duration limited for a lot.
Mr. Michael, does it allow additional increment to be collected by adding a couple of years?
So, yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, it will have that practical effect because typically what happens as the new building is being built the first year, you'll get just a very small amount, so you drop that amount out, or maybe the value of the land has gone up a little bit and that generates increments. So this election allows them to drop that out of the duration limit and add the year at the end where you get, you know, the full property tax paid by the development. So that's the reason they want this.
I understand it, but why do we not, if we want to do that, why do we just not collect the increment the first couple of years?
Senator Bach, I mean, I think Representative Mullery and I think the League of Minnesota Cities and others came and testified in support of this. So I think Representative Mullery was, you know, talking about the incidents where the first year your TIF clock starts, you might collect, you know, $100. But a couple of years in, you're looking at the whole reason you had the TIF district, and some of the TIF districts are 8 years, so if you lose a couple, trying to raise it up, does it really make the project work? I don't know. You know, I thought they had a good policy argument. And
Madam Chair, I know Representative Mullery introduces a lot of legislation. I'm just curious if he had a Senate author for this, because we don't remember seeing this.
This is a lot of Minnesota cities.
It's really, it's a league priority.
Scary would probably.
In fact, I
was reading the League of Minnesota Cities recommendations. I think their task force is called like Fiscal Futures or something like that. Restoring the state-local relationship, and they have this as a priority. But so I don't know. Maybe there is a Senate offer. Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, why are economic development districts carved out?
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, the reason, as Senator Bach was pointing out, basically you're in effect adding one or two years of duration, effective duration to this. And of course, when you think about the finances of these districts, with a redevelopment district, you're talking about a 25-year district. So you keep in mind sort of the time value of money. You're adding, at the end of 25 years, you're adding two more years of increment. With an economic development district, you're potentially adding a year or two of increment for an 8-year district. And so really, there's a much larger percentage increase in the amount of increment, the financial benefit to an economic development district. And secondly, I think the House members sort of thought that the core purpose for tax increment is really more redevelopment than housing. And so both because this would be more financially beneficial to economic development districts and because the higher priority is for redevelopment and housing, the decision, the League's original bill applied across the board, and the working group in the House decided to drop out economic development districts for that reason, because the benefit to them would be disproportionately larger than to redevelopment, and they were considered to be a lower priority.
So, Madam Chair, if we're trying to tighten TIF, why would we add 2 years to that?
Well, Senator Bach, I think what the League was arguing is they're trying to get 25 years for a 25-year housing district, and they're saying that really the effect of it is the first couple of years are really not getting anything. But what Mr. Michael said is correct. The economic development ones, which are the ones that are questionable, I mean, they're all questionable, but I think a lot of people here understand that the economic development ones are a harder argument to make that we even allow them, and that TIF, in my mind, is for housing and for blighted sites, not for economic development. And that's where people start arguing, you know, because we'll pay more taxes, we should get to not pay our taxes. I don't know. It becomes a real circular argument for me, but people make it with a straight face. So I think they were arguing that in 25 years of a housing district or a true redevelopment of blighted site, that they were maybe getting 23 years, really, of money to make the project go, and they wanted to make the whole thing work. But I think you're making a legitimate argument, too. I mean, we could just say no, because that's growing, you know, the amount of the increment they're going to get out of those districts. Senator Moore?
And maybe Mr. Michaels could share with us, where, how did they arrive at the 4 years? Was it just kind of pulled out of thin air, or was there some kind of rationale behind that?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, this is a League of Cities bill. There actually was a provision in the old law similar to this, and it also had a four-year period. I think the reality is it's really 2 years is the important number, and with 4 years, it just gives them a little more flexibility, but I don't know, the league might be better able to talk to, you know, why they picked the 4 years. I really don't know.
Madam Chair? People that want to get something included in the Senate tax bill should have been paying attention to the committee deadlines, because I noticed Senator or Representative Mullery's bill has a number of like 2100 and something. And if my hunch is correct and Senator Dibble introduced it, I think there's a pretty good likelihood it was introduced after the Senate tax bill had left the station. So my message to people who want to have things included in the bill is, if they come too late, wait till next year.
Okay,
I don't think this is an idea that just popped up on the, you know, the 28th of February someday.
We still have them popping up on our side as of this week. They're always a crisis.
And we think Senator Dibble might have authored this, but very much suspect it probably has an introduction laid out. Could be after the Senate bill was long gone. Not that we wouldn't have considered it, but.
We'll help you consider it. Mr. Michael.
Section 10 is, again, another provision of the TIF technical bill. And it modifies there are two parts to the but-for finding. One is there's a required finding that the project that's being financed will not go forward without the tax increment. That's not changed. But there's a second requirement that the city has to find that this project would result in a larger market value development than other projects that would happen without tax increment. What this section does is to exempt housing districts from that finding, and this is sort of tied up with the repeal of the rules for qualified housing districts. And the rationale behind this change is that the reason for doing housing districts and projects is to stimulate the construction of low and moderate income housing that otherwise wouldn't occur. And in some cases, those sites may actually develop for some other use, like commercial use or regular market value housing that would have a higher market value. And so it was thought inappropriate to subject all housing districts to that test, that they have to find that, gee, no other development of this site could actually result in a higher market value, because the purpose is just to develop more low and moderate income housing. Section 12, another technical provision. This is the state auditor found that there was a mistake in the cross references in the excess increment statute. And then the second part of this gives the auditor flexibility to exempt cities from this calculation if they're a long ways away from being close to violating it. Section 13 clarifies that you can use tax increment for publicly owned parking facilities. This is just an instance where the way the law was drafted when it was changed back in, I think, 2003,
created some ambiguity that these had to be privately owned parking facilities, but of course that was not intended, because TIF has been used by a wide variety of cities to build parking ramps that are publicly owned. For example, Minneapolis, Duluth, St. Paul, various other places have done this. Section 14, again, is tied up with the repeal of this qualified housing districts, which is sort of really an obsolete provision that was tied to the old state aid offset, and it provides that you can do any kind of housing district on a green acres site. Section 15 is another housing district provision, and this relates to how the restrictions on square footage apply when you're doing an addition to an existing building. And essentially what this allows is you just, so long as all you're doing is financing the addition, you just look at the addition and applying the square foot test, not the existing building that you're adding on to. Section 16 is a bill that Representative Dabney authored that affects the way TIF districts in bioscience zones are allowed to spend their money. Under current law, they're only allowed to spend this money for paying for public infrastructure. This section expands it to include land acquisition and other redevelopment type costs, so demolition and that sort of thing would be covered. Section 7.
Representative Abney.
Just to clarify, the hope is that these zones are successful and that the companies in the zones are successful and are going to need to expand. And this simply allows the increment to be used to provide them some assistance in that expansion.
Madam Chair, the previous provisions to this, 9 through 15, mm-hmm. I don't remember seeing any of those. How many bills was that?
Senator Bach, I was just thinking the same thing. Did you guys not do a TIF technical bill?
It was introduced after.
Yeah. Madam Chair, we received the Senate jackets after the Senate bill had passed the Senate floor.
Were you the Senate author?
Somebody sent me the Senate jackets after the bill passed.
I think we were hoping that the TIF articles would still be alive for you in your public finance bill, but you put that in here too. You got everything in.
The Senate is very efficient.
And quick. So, Senator Bach, I think we were all thrown for a loop when the Senate passed their tax bill. Has the Senate ever passed a tax bill that early in the history of Minnesota legislature? No. We think we're really early, too. And you're ahead of us.
It was passed before the 1st of April.
That's amazing.
We'd have to have some research done.
I think, Senator Bach, I think that's it. I mean, the TIF, you know, technical bill comes out of the practitioners who are looking at good policy stuff mostly. They're really not trying to promote individual projects. And so they're trying to, you know, see what the industry has consensus on. And I was given the jackets, and I put them in. We heard them. I think I sent them to you, and I apologize for that. I think we had hoped. We were still debating whether we'd have our TIF in our public finance bill or not. And we found out you've had your TIF and your public finance in the tax bill. We're still working on the public finance bill. In fact, we're going to have hearings on it this week. So we haven't even put the omnibus public finance bill together yet. So
we've already done the work for you.
It was a timing
you.
Thing.
We've already done the work for you.
We appreciate that. Senator Moi.
Madam Chair, in Section 15, I wonder if Mr. Michael could talk a little bit about the new language. Is that in response to a particular concern that arose? It seems to be the wording of it seems to be a little bit specific.
Mr. Michael, I think this actually helped the housing districts be able to do more thing and spread their money a little further, but Mr. Michael, I don't remember a specific instance.
Madam Chair, Senator Moi, this
This is the situation with an individual project is what stimulated this provision, although the state auditor told me that this issue has come up in other contexts. And so, and I did not, this is one of the, this is, I think, the only provision of the technical bill that I did not draft. It was drafted by a practitioner for make it clear that it works for an individual project. And again, it is a situation where there's an existing building and the project is to do a housing addition to that existing building. And in law, there's a square footage test for housing districts that says you can't assist a building if more than 20% of its square feet are non-housing uses. And so there's a sort of a lack of clarity as to, well, how do you apply that test when you're adding on to a building? Do you count the existing building or don't you? And obviously that, I mean, if you were, all, depending upon how you write the language, it could be open to game playing, et cetera. The solution that was that's in this is to say, well, the existing building had to be there for at least 3 years, and it could not have been contemplated in the TIF plan, then you can go ahead and treat it as a separate building for the 20% square or the 20% square footage test. But I would agree this language, when I first read it, I didn't totally understand it until I talked to the bond lawyer that had drafted it, and then I understood what it was doing. So,
Senator Moore?
Well, Madam Chair, I once again, I mean, I think that from a drafting perspective, if it's going to be that complicated to understand, you have to go do some research to interpret what it says. Maybe Mr. Michaels can, no disrespect to the original drafter, but if it's that difficult to try to understand from our perspective as people who are reading it, maybe there's a different way to address that.
Thank you. That's a good idea. We did Dabney and Section 17, Mr. Michael?
Section 17 of the House bill, another provision from the TIF technical bill, is directed at Ramsey County. Ramsey County is the only county that anyone is aware of that's using a unique procedure for deciding when to certify original tax capacity. The county there is following a procedure where they wait until the value of the certified district increases before they certify it. Every other county is certifying it when the request is made. Since the clock starts running for a few limits under tax increment or based on when the certification occurred, the group that was working on the technical bill felt that that was sort of an inappropriate deviation from the general rule. And so this adds language that essentially will make it more difficult for Ramsey County to continue following that practice. Section 18, just there's somehow the statute on interfund loans is missing two words that adds those back. Section 19, again, is another one of those special one of the housing districts language, and this is in a statute that's never been used, so you could actually probably repeal it as another alternative. I think that's all of the general law TIF provisions that are in either of the two bills.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair and Mr. Michaels, the Ramsey County provision, was there a special circumstance that led them to this practice, or are they just mavericks who just didn't care to act like everyone else?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that. I've never talked to them. The state auditor has had a number of conversations with them. I think it's probably they were just mavericks, or they thought that, I think their view of it is that this is their system is a efficient system because it keeps these TIF districts off the books until they actually has an effect on computations, but that has been the unintended consequence of sort of allowing a longer period of time for Ramsey County municipalities than would be the case for someone located in Dakota or Hennepin or, you know, St. Louis or any place else in the state.
Madam Chair, how does that jive with this optional four-year? Are they, I mean, it's, what I'm hearing is the similar effect, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Moi, sort of, but not really, because what you can have, Ramsey County would go ahead and certify the district, and in fact, we had to, the legislature had to sort of adjust for this with a couple of St. Paul districts, where if the value went up by a very small amount, so let's say the assessor said, ah, the land value has increased by 1%, that would then cause them to certify and would start to generate increment. I remember that tank farm district in St. Paul, I think Representative Dawkins had a bill because they collected $186 of increment in 1 year to ignore that in the duration limit. So the Ramsey County practice doesn't stop that sort of dribble of increment coming in. What it would do is it would sort of mitigate the need for the delay only in the sense that, I guess I take that back, it wouldn't mitigate that at all, because the duration limits based on increments would only be triggered by an increase in the value of the district, and then Ramsey would certify. The next section of the House bill is the first of the Farm Z provisions. And this is the definition of what kind of farm qualifies for Farm Z. And essentially, Farm Z provides Job Z type tax benefits to on-farm egg processing facilities. And in order to qualify, the on-farm employment excluding family members needs to increase by 25% in order to qualify. And the tax benefits are limited to the egg processing facility that's located on the farm. Section 20.
Excuse me, Senator Squire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've been looking at the language on this qualified farm, and I had a couple of questions. I guess I'm assuming that when you're talking about the previous year's gross revenue, that would be the farm revenue.
What page are you on, Senator?
It's 160 in the House.
160. Mr. Mike.
Senator Stowe, yes, I believe, you know, in most of these instances, the processing facility would not be operating before they're doing this, so it would be looking at the farm's revenues.
Madam Chair and Mr. Michaels, but it would it be off the Schedule F, or would it be off the 1040 form?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Senator Stowe, I believe what you would look at is the Schedule F, if in fact that's, you know, in a classic farm situation, that's the only gross revenues. If they've already got some processing facility that would be on C, you know, then it would be the combination of the F and C schedules. But I think in most situations, like you were suggesting, they haven't opened the processing facility, so all they would have is their Schedule F.
And Madam Chair, I don't know where this came from. We didn't have this in the Senate. What would happen if there was a farm processing facility that, you know, required by volume more than one farm to go together? You know, you have these volume efficiencies scale that get benefits if you have a larger deal. Could two farms go together and pool their gross revenue and locate on one farm, or how would that work?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoie, the language would allow on
farm processing facility to process egg products from another farm. There's no restriction that it only be from that farm, but the tests would all apply only on that farm. So you could have the situation where two or three neighboring farmers go together and say, well, let's, I mean, the example that Representative Junkie has always used is a cheese plant. I don't know if that's, and I can imagine that this could, you know, have applications for like apple orchards or something, you know. But anyway, you could have three farmers go together and say, okay, we're going to put the, you know, the small cheese plant on one farm, and we're going to process, you know, products from all three farms. And the test would then still look only at the farm where it's actually located. It wouldn't take into account these other farms because it's not physically located on them.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Michael, so if there was a group that got together as a small farm co-op or something, it would still be limited to whatever the farm site that it's located on. And then, Madam Chair and Mr. Michaels, is there, do the relocation restrictions apply to this provision? I was kind of looking ahead at your stuff for the job Z. Would they apply to this also?
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, I think they would apply, but it's unlikely they would have application because you're not, you know, you're not relocating on, you know, another egg processing facility on. But if in fact that's what was happening, then it would relocation provisions we'll get to next. You'd have to relocate 25 jobs in order for that to kick in. So it's a fairly large facility.
Madam Chair and Mr. Michaels, I'm thinking about, you know, I mean, there's a lot of different types of farm activities that I could see this, you know, applying to beyond making cheese a potato wash plant. And, you know, most farms are having their potatoes washed somewhere now. And they decided to do that on farm to take advantage of this subsidy, would that be a good word? You know, perhaps the relocation restrictions would have to apply because they would be moving the jobs from wherever they currently are onto their farm.
Mr. Michael?
Senator Scoy, yes, if there's an existing potato washing facility that hires, that has 25 or more employees and that were to shut down and relocate and qualify for benefits under this, the relocation would apply. The veto power, essentially, for where that facility is now would apply.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Michaels, the limit on the subsidy really is that it only applies to the site that the new plant is going to be located, farmers' gross revenue. So that would be a limiting to how much the subsidy would be.
Yes.
Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This seems to be one of Representative Junkie's proposals that he's come forward with, and he seemed to think that there are possibilities where you would see small processors start to do on-farm processing. And to Senator Bach's comments earlier, I think this would certainly be put in rural areas due to the fact of the location. But last night we had some discussion about Senator Stump. Perhaps this could be that marquee that he would like. I believe he's in the grape processing business. Maybe he could set his farm up into a production site and winery, and this could be that carrot that you were looking for him.
Madam Chair, I wonder if a vineyard would apply.
Egg processing facility, Senator Bach, probably. I don't know.
I would believe it would.
Might. Senator Bach and Senator Scoy, though, you should both know that this is a modified Junkie proposal. He actually was asking for more than this, and we limited it, and I think at some point it's worth Mr. Michael explaining what we're changing as far as moving parcels around within the current Job Z. We're using that farmsy as well, tighten the language so on net we're not going to have more. I know you. We understand with Jobs E eliminated as the Senate would like, then farmsy would be too. But we did not want to grow farmsy on top of Jobs E. So we're trying to say this can qualify, but on net, you're not getting more. So just so you understand, Representative Junkie, to be fair to him, I think wanted it on top of, and he wanted to include family members, and so we modified that. Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, on the bottom of page 162, the last line, and then continuing on the top of page 163, is where my rub really is. In making the designations, the commissioner shall, not me, shall consider need and likelihood of success to yield the most economic development and revitalization of economically distressed rural areas of the state. That's where they're supposed to be designated. And that is my rub. I don't think that's been happening. And the commissioner of deed is going to get an opportunity to come into the tax committee one of these days for his confirmation hearing, and that is one of the questions I'm going to ask. Does the commissioner really think that that is how the department has made the designations of zone acreage? The language, I thought, as the author, was very clear. You know, Madam Chair, I think I'll have staff see if we can dust off a couple recent studies. I think I'm starting to think that we make too much out of tax structure as it relates to businesses' decisions whether to expand or relocate. And I think the failure of Jobs E and most rural areas of the state, I think, shows that there are, when a business is going to expand or relocate, they look at a number of considerations. And the tax climate is just one of them. And I believe there are a number of studies around, and we'll try to find a couple for the committee, that clearly show that there are other considerations that are significantly more important that the potential business evaluates when they look at the criteria. And I believe most of them will bear out that the availability of a labor force is probably the number one criteria that they look at before they make a decision to expand or relocate. And another one that's, I think, very high in most studies is transportation issues. And I have learned both have significantly more importance in that business's decision than does the tax climate. Because the tax climate really doesn't mean anything if you can't overcome the transportation obstacles, if you can't find the workforce that you need to perform the duties. I'm starting to learn more that the tax climate has really, I won't say nothing to do, but very little to do with the business's decision.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I think this is a good discussion, and I think we had a bit of this in tax committee a few weeks ago when Mr. Kramer was in. And when you look at taxes, it's clearly one of many factors, but certain people in Minnesota who think, you know, if we bring our taxes down like Mississippi and so on, we'll be great business climate. And if you look state nationally, I think a couple of years ago I saw that the top five states and the highest overall tax burden for their people were, every one of those five states were in the top 10 in terms of revenue, personal income left after taxes. And you take the five lowest tax states and every one of them was in the bottom 10 states in revenue left after taxes, for personal income after taxes, which does suggest that, you know, if we keep bringing down taxes to the Mississippi type of level, we'll have a Mississippi type economy. And of course, each business decision, of course, is one factor, but as Senator Bach said, I mean, it's transportation and health for their employees and their employees' education and training. And again, with Jobs E type of things where we eliminate all the taxes. Well, we eliminate all taxes in society. You don't have roads, you don't have anything. And I think that's the issue, that in this case it's added to the fact that we're having some people pay nothing and others paying more to make up for it. I think we got to keep in mind that taxes are one factor, and maybe the solution to everything isn't eliminating the taxes.
You know, Madam Chair, it's interesting if you look at the charts of, and there's data going back for decades about how Minnesota's personal income growth has been some of the highest in the nation compared to other states, the way our personal income is growing per capita. And over those decades, we've heard criticism after criticism after criticism about how businesses are treated so unfairly in this state. And it's really hampering economic development. But at the same time, personal income has been growing faster than most states. And in recent years, this legislature has done a lot to reduce the tax burden on businesses. I mean, we've cut business taxes significantly. I mean, the class rate on CI when I came here, I think, was about 5.6%, if I remember right. Now we're down to 2%. And we've cut income taxes, we've cut license tabs, cut a whole lot of things that the business community benefits from. And I mean, I don't object to giving them some tax breaks, but it's interesting that Minnesota's growth in personal income in the recent few years has been slipping compared to the rest of the country. And it does kind of beg the question. I mean, when we have been cutting business taxes, how come we haven't seen some kind of corresponding increase in personal income? And why has the growth in personal income in Minnesota started to slip, when prior to the tax-cutting frenzy we've been on the last few years, personal income was growing at some of the fastest rates in the country? So I'm just not sure there's a correlation between business taxes and growth in personal income in the state. And I just don't think the data proves that out. And I think something, I think the tax committee, you know, as we move forward on state tax policy, I think we need to spend more time talking about, because I'm not sure the business community's message that cutting business property taxes is good for the economy overall, I'm not sure it's true.
Representative Carlson and Skoyan, do you have me?
Just
Carlson.
To reinforce what you're saying, a few years ago when we were at the height of one of these debates, I happened to be in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's my wife's hometown, reading the Charlotte Observer. You'd have read the article in the paper, instead of substituting, having North Carolina being referenced, and substituted the word Minnesota, I would have thought I was back home. And by the way, they then point to South Carolina rather than South Dakota with all of that same kind of revenue we sometimes hear. But I agree. You know, when we began to make those investments back in the 50s, and many would say under the administration of Orville Freeman, in education and higher education through that entire period, that's when we had those big changes in income. So you have to make those kinds of investments if you're going improve the income and the job climate, in my view. But it's kind of interesting how that rhetoric is used in other places where those of us at this table would probably perceive them as low tax states in the same debate.
Senator Spy.
Kind of along what Senator Bach was saying, and maybe somebody could research. I read an article, and I didn't research where they got their information, but they had some statistics in it that was a little surprising. And I think in the last 4 years, Minnesota's per capita income has fallen from 6th in the nation to 12th, which is certainly should be a concern to all of us. But the most, to me, the most distressing number was that we are 49th in income growth in 50 states. So not only are we dropping from 6th to 12th, our growth is very slow, so it very likely is going to fall farther before we turn this around. And, you know, those are pretty startling numbers.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bach, one of the more memorable days in Tax Committee this year, other than the wastewater treatment day, was when we entertained the question of whether to change the capital equipment sales tax from a refund to a
upfront exemption.
Upfront, yeah, thank you. And there were a number of manufacturers who came in, and they made their case very well, very persuasively. One member of the tax committee asked one of them, if I'm remembering correctly, it was a multi-generational business. You know, the guy had clearly grown up in the business and had now taken over. What did you need to be successful in Minnesota? And he went on a remarkably eloquent, spontaneous speech about what he needed was an educated workforce. What he needed was vo-tech education in the schools, because he needed folks who knew how to work with their hands but also knew the math and the science behind what they were doing. He needed a change in the culture to be more respectful of blue-collar jobs, and that for kids in the schools in particular to not get a message that if you're going off in that direction that somehow you're not really living up to hopes and dreams. He needed international trade agreements that didn't incent people to ship their jobs overseas, but instead to keep their manufacturing here in America and in Minnesota. Very eloquent, very passionate, very persuasive, and never once mentioned taxes. And that was kind of, in my mind, echoed probably 6 weeks later when we entertained the Thompson West and Mall of America folks on the same day with Dr. Rolnick from the Federal Reserve, who really made many of the same arguments that we shouldn't be looking at tax subsidies, that much of this business development would occur regardless, and that what we needed to do was put investments into the workforce, as you mentioned. How educated are they? How capable are they of being retrained and shifted as developments occur? Things like that. I think you would have found both days to be very striking and very reinforcing.
It was very compelling testimony. I think everybody was pretty struck that day, and we all have those hearings where everybody is paying very close attention, and that was one for us with 27 members, and everybody was listening closely. It was a very good discussion.
Madam Chair, were you struck enough to put the upfront exemption in the bill? Because I do think it's good policy.
It is good policy. We didn't have enough one-time money because we used it to buy the transition aid we need for our property tax relief.
I would like to do that upfront exemption if we can find a way to squeeze the money out of leadership. I mean, we had some very good testimony from small business people who came with, I mean, reams of paper that they have to go through to wade through just to get the money back that they're supposed to be able to get, and pretty strong indications that a lot of people, you know, small businesses just don't have the staff, the resources available to wade through the paperwork and don't get the refund that they're eligible for back. I'm not sure as a matter of policy we're on the right track there, and an upfront exemption might, from a policy standpoint, be much better than the way we're currently doing it. So if we can somehow squeeze the leadership some one-time money to do that, we really would like to do the Senate position on that. Good use of one-time money, I think. Anyway, when I met with one of the large mining companies in Minnesota, in fact, our largest one from Pittsburgh that's located here, they indicated to me that they really supported the Senate position on the upfront exemption, and they said that would allow us to immediately put $8 to $9 million reinvested back into our facility this year that we wouldn't have to give to the state and then apply to get back. There might be a little one-time bump in some additional capital spending on the part of the business community, because it will free up some money in the first year at least to make some additional investment.
And we heard that bill, and we heard testifiers with their tax data, and I think we all think it's good policy as well. It's just finding the money. Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair. Before we leave Farm Z, and I don't know right. if we are or not,
We've got more.
I have two kind of specific questions, and I'm real interested in figuring out a way to help agriculture and value added. I think this is a good direction. I'm not sure of what we're doing in this, but just a couple of questions. So do I understand then, in order to get the Farm Z program, the region has to have unused Job Z to transfer in?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, yes. As Representative Junkie had originally introduced his bill, it authorized the Commissioner of Trade of Economic Development to simply designate as many, you know, of these zones as the commissioner wished. The change that the tax committee made was to say that they would be subject to, essentially, that you would have to transfer existing Job Z parcels in order to use this, and it would be subject to the duration limit that applies to Job Z, so it wouldn't be stretching this out beyond the termination of the existing Job Z law.
And Chair, I'm not an expert on Job Z. I don't know if there's a lot of acres out there that aren't designated that you can transfer. That's something that I'd have to take a look at. The other question, and then you guys brought it up with Senator Stumpf, is somebody must have, we should look at what the definition of processing is to see what that would entail and take a little look at that too. And maybe Senator Moi and our little egg group, we could take a run at that, huh?
I would like that.
Thank you. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members, Section 21 is the House's anti-pirating provision, which requires a business that's located in Minnesota that's going to relocate or transfer an existing operation into Job Z that involves 25 jobs or more to notify the local governments at that location, both the city and the county, and that the local governments, after receiving the notification, would have up to 60 days to veto the relocation. But in order to do that, the city or the county would have to have a site that's large enough to accommodate this new development and has sufficient transportation and infrastructure and be available to the business. Sections 22 and 23 relate to the Farm Z rules, which we've already covered, and so I won't go through it in as much detail. Basically, it makes it clear that it's only the egg processing part of the farm that gets the tax benefits, and it's only the increase in income of the operation, that the percentage increase that gets it, to sort of prevent the operator from, through the pricing of the products to the processing facility, essentially transfer income into the processing facility, making it exempt. Sales tax exemption only applies to the processing facility and so forth. Section 23 has the provision that says that this is essentially transfer of unused Job Z parcels, not new designation. Section 24, again, returns to the state auditor's authority on Job Z audits, and gives the auditor authority to request from the Commissioner of Revenue return information in order to do those jobs.
Members of the conference committee, I think people look hungry and sleepy. We had too much fun here last night. Senator Bach, you and I talked about next steps for similar provisions. Are there other items we can assign to staff to work on? And also, are there interests of members of the conference committee? We've identified one here, Ag. Things that people want to work on that we can have a few members figure out and come back. I know Senator Ma has always worked on 4D for us. I know Representative Dabney stepped out. He's probably the person who'd like to on our side. But are there other subject areas that we can actually have people begin to get this stuff done for us? Mr. Michael's got a list right here. I forgot I asked him about this. Possible issues for subgroups of the conference committee. So we've got, here's some thoughts. Changes in the classification and qualification rules for homestead farm classification rules, relative homesteads, rural lands, resorts. Get Representative Simpson's attention there. We've got relative homesteads for regular homes. As we prohibit new qualifications and you require registrations. 4D. We talked about that, and disabled veterans property tax rules. So members have interest in some of these. I think it's more efficient for a member on each side or two on each side who care about them to work them out and bring them back. What do you think, Senator Bach?
I think that's a good idea, and I would add maybe if council could go through this side by side and bring us all the studies, maybe we could kind of make some decision on what those criteria would be. We'd study and then have Mr. Manson tell us what they think they could feasibly get done for us. And then council could maybe get the studies issue behind us in the bill draft also.
Are there other? Because I've kind of been writing them in the margins while we've been doing it too, but I've only hit ones that Mr. Michael's come up with. Rural vacant land, I had homestead of disabled veterans. I mean, are there others that...
Well, there are a number of same and similar that we can go through. These
that would
are
be
ones
helpful.
Where I thought, you know,
you're just
going to be discussion. So
Senator Bach, are you okay with also directing staff to go through the whole bill again with same and similar? And also here, anybody who's interested in these subgroups, let us know. We'll just have folks work on those. Yes, Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, I'd be glad to work with whoever on the 4D provisions. Mm-hmm. But I seem to recall last night that you and Senator Bach had agreed that Representative Daphne and I would do all the LGA.
Senator Bach, what do you think about letting Representative Daphne and Senator Moore do all the LGA?
I'm comfortable with the Senate member.
We'll just have to keep thinking about that. Senator Stewart.
I must have misheard, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, the aid group that we have, I think it's four here. Can we kind of, you know, if we come across some ag issues and then vacant lands is going to probably play into it, then green acres and a little latitude on some of that?
I'm comfortable with that. I just think when we get into money, that gets to be the problem. But we should start with non-money and then move to concept, and then it's money. Well, works for me.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Simpson would be on that ag group if you would like to be. But we could also maybe do the resorts because it looks like it would also
be the same people.
Yeah. So the ag and resorts.
That'd be great.
And
that. Any other ideas for groups or things we can offload to the staff? I think it was really helpful today to adopt as many provisions as we did. You know, I don't know if we can do the TIF straight up because that gets pretty complicated as we go through. We've got some pretty controversial provisions, but maybe some of the ones that are less so, you know, so we've identified already some issues that we need staff to all a few cities. I guess maybe the TIF technical provisions would be easy part for a few members to take a look at. What do you think, Senator Mock?
Madam Chair, how about if you and I try to work with council on the TIF stuff and try to get some of the more pure technical things and non-controversial things out of the way. And
sounds good.
Be able to bring some recommendations back on.
It's my second.
Easy.
Yeah, and for people who are listening, we don't mean the city specific and project specific. We just mean the actual policy stuff. So, right. Other thoughts?
Unless, of course, we have identical language on both sides on a provision, we probably would bring that back.
Well, I appreciate everyone being here on a Saturday. I sure hope Senator Pogelmiller and Speaker Kelleher appreciate us all being here on a Saturday. Do you think they do, Senator Buck?
Madam Chair, it would be nice if these groups could meet some between now and Monday when we reconvene.
It would be.
We'll get some of this work done so that when we get here Monday, we are a little further along than we are right now.
Yes. Senator Bach, I agree. I think we should plan to be voting on some things on Monday because we need to start clearing the decks on particularly same and similar and non-money items because we all know that the way the process works is the contention will come after that. So we don't want to lose the policy and the stuff that needs to get done because we are having more contention across the table. So,
Madam Chair, does that sound like we'll be having a budget target on Monday in my hearing or?
You know something. I hope you'll tell us because I haven't heard that. And,
I didn't get in on the 12 to 1 a.m. meeting last night, so I'm not sure.
No target.
How did we get that number?
I believe when we asked, we never even got an answer. Fact. Good, bad, or otherwise.
I think they looked the other way.
They ignored us.
clock's ticking. I believe Monday will be 2 weeks from adjournment. So.
Exactly.
Madam Chair, does Representative Dietrich golf?
Representative Dietrich, we were going to ask you if you golfed. I thought you did golf. Do you golf?
Madam Chair, yes.
Ah. So does Senator Bach. There's still time today, but I think we do. Seriously, members who are volunteering to do these things, we appreciate it, and we do need to work on those today. And we need to work with staff today to get some of that stuff done. And, Senator Bach, what you got going here? State of Minnesota? Look at that. Is this another gift from the Senate?
Keep turning. What am I
looking for? Oh my gosh. He's got golf balls that say Senator Thomas Bach.
Oh, we're gonna need.
I didn't know there was such a thing. Does Pulaski have these too?
They don't say Senator.
How long are you going
on? Wow. Is this a gift?
So, Madam Chair.
Or is this sort of our mascot for the rest of the
session? I brought for the members of the committee who would like to go. You know, I think it would be helpful if members took at least part of the day off tomorrow, went and played a little bit, and forgot about work because, Representative Simpson, you're right. Next week, Monday, we got to bear down here, and we're going to be working some long hours for 2 weeks here. So I think this weekend might be your last opportunity. Maybe if you can squeeze a little time on Sunday, those that want to go play a round of golf. Mr. Matson, I brought a sleeve of golf balls for you.
Oh, thank you.
And others that want to golf, please help yourself to a sleeve of golf balls. But don't be fooled. Expect these are going to get lost on golf courses around the Twin Cities. Maybe part of a future campaign committee. I set up a little name recognition for me. never know. And those of you that don't golf, don't be misled because I brought something for you, but don't be misled by the insignificant value of it.
Okay.
Because you're going to get the opportunity, if you choose not to have a golf ball, to have a pen with the picture of the chairman on it. No. This may not look like it has significant value today, but you just never know what value it is. So if you decide to select a pen instead of a sleeve of golf balls,
are you announcing something?
You may be the winner someday because these are a limited edition.
Limited edition.
And There won't be any more like it produced. Certainly, I had more hair when this picture was taken. And that's unlikely I'm going to get more again.
Senator Mott. The gallery may check eBay tonight if they wish.
Senator Bach, would those golf balls slice right or full left?
Well, I actually golf left-handed, so these tend to go to the left because I have a slice that I can't seem to correct. My wife tells me I don't twist my body enough. So that's why I have that slice.
I was going to say, if I hadn't been here this morning, I would have been at a hockey game, and my grandson, who's now 9, just had Grandpa buy some hockey pucks the other day. So being that you were from up north, I would have expected if you want to build name recognition, and by the way, he plays up in the Becker Big Lake area, you might need some hockey pucks.
Look at all of you. Oh.
What do you
generous.
Think?
Oh,
look at there. That is
Senator
cool.
Senator Marty, yes, he's generous.
That is cool.
Representative Dietrich, what do you think?
I'm just dreaming.
Could you play around the golf with a
I'm
golf ball with my name on
I'm just dreaming about myself on the golf course tomorrow. That's...
Go.
Well, you should take a golf. You can take
well,
a
Senator
golf.
Bach again.
And the...
Cool.
Yeah.
That is cool.
Senator
Bach. Senator Martin's got it figured
out there. I'm a bad golfer. When I go golfing, I'm using
the
beef because
the
it's got his name on it.
Right.
Boy.
Well, we have Senator Bach.
And I do lose a few seconds.
Well. And in all seriousness, Senator Bach, you've been very generous and have brought gifts again. So the House has noticed that once again you brought gifts and... We'll have to respond. We'll have to figure it out. With that, we appreciate everybody. We thank you for your gifts, and we want everybody to work hard today so they can golf tomorrow or use their pen. And so we're not planning on meeting till Monday, and we thank everyone for being here. And with that, we are adjourned.
Madam Chair, I think probably after the last body adjourns on Monday, I would think.